real community. That'll make my job easier these days. And then you can just hit it and relax and take off from there. And I think you all have need another introduction to Dan, but the few of you are new, and I don't think you'll be disappointed with his experience and his commentary. And whatever he can give to you for the day is worth its weight in gold. So
that's too much
to me.
Can well, I it's here, so it's weight very much, I guess.
Yeah,
hot air. It rises. All right. Thank you, Philip, for making this happen. Much appreciated. So I always like to start up front questions. I hopefully have stimulated some thoughts and maybe some research practices. So if there's things people are struggling with, or curious about, or liking to elucidate further, I'd love to just jot a quick list of that, and I can deal with it as we pass through the day.
You probably can't help
it.
How did I miss the first?
How did you miss the first? I have no idea. If you're not careful, we may be doing this again in the future. So, sometimes people feel like they come two or three times and they actually hear it. It takes a little while for the gears to shift into a different frequency range. The paradigm shift doesn't just happen like that. So, yeah.
Last time you were telling us about putting the minerals on gradually.
Yes.
And not putting them on just before planting time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, I need some more guidance about what to put on in the early season and
what to put on now.
Later and mid and so forth.
Okay. Now and then through the season. Good. Well, that's what our topic is for the day, is what do we do from now through the rest of the season, mm-hmm. step-wise.
Okay.
So that should be, but I can certainly do that.
Related to that, when I went down to this other course, they were preparing the beds, putting the minerals on, and then into it. So I just wanted, maybe you could talk a little bit more about why you wouldn't do that.
Why?
Or if it matters, or...
Why minerals mean fall?
And if it really, can you do that? Can you just, if you haven't done it yet, put it on?
Yes. Yes, you can. But you're going to not get the effect until probably fall time. And if you put minerals on in the fall, you'd have to get the effect starting in the spring. It'll take a little while for it to kick into gear.
I didn't see background levels for aluminum and iron, or what your...
Yes.
Is.
I didn't cover those last time, could I? Okay.
I think you touched on this last time. If you could do it again, the few most essential things to add if you're growing mostly in compost.
If you're growing mostly in compost, okay, compost specifically. All right. Yes.
Question about building up topsoil where you don't have enough topsoil, and it's only 6 or 8 inches, and above below that is just a rocky layer. How would you build that up over time?
How do you build soil? Only 6 or 8 inches, he says. Where I come from, we have rocks.
Well, that's sort of it, with rocks, but yeah.
Yes.
We have a test with us. What can we do to make it good?
That was what we did last time. First half of the course. I can give you some quick pointers probably during break, but we're not time to go over that today. Sorry. That's it? Something else. I'll get it started. All right. I'll review these things right now while they're fresh. And ideally, the more dialogue there is, the better. Everybody knows that? Conversation, engagement, learning. I give this presentation all over the place. I don't need to hear myself anymore. So the more you ask questions, the more you think about your specific situation and make sure that what I'm saying is relevant to you if you have questions asked. If I use words that you don't understand, probably the people don't understand them also. My bad for not using the proper vernacular. What to put on now into the season? Basically, talking about mineral soil testing, mineral applications. The first thing when it comes to all this is follow through. you know, the principles are nice, the concepts are nice, but until you actually start to do something, it doesn't really matter, right? Everybody okay with that? Yeah? Follow through. And that's usually what is the reason why it takes you so long to get results, is because you simply are not just doing the basic things you need to do. So one of them is to identify limiting factors as far as a mineralogical profile and address them. Just get them onto the soil. So certainly if you haven't done it yet, now is great. It's certainly better than next fall. And pretty soon you're going to run out of time. So you definitely have time now. I wouldn't plant anything into the soil until it was 50 degrees, 5-0, 2 inches down. So people may be all excited about it's going to be 60 degrees today, let's go out and plant something. You know, it's going to be another couple of weeks at least until the soil warms up. And there's some cheats about how you can warm soil up fast if you want to, but you know, it's not like it's tomorrow, or it shouldn't be tomorrow that you're going to go out and planting unless you're in a hoop house type environment. So whatever it is, your, you know, rock phosphate, limestone, gypsum, green sand, all those things, no problem putting them down now. I certainly said, was the other question about the slow overtime applications? Who asked the question about building in general overtime?
Yeah.
Is that your question? You know, if you see you have dramatic calcium deficiency, I'm recommending you do not apply that entirely all at once. Right, so this is your maximum yearly application, so go by that. Do a step forward, which is your max yearly applications of all your minerals. You can do it now, and while you won't have the benefit you would have had if you put them down in the fall, they will be digested and used as the season progresses. The thing to be careful about putting down now is your trace elements. Copper, zinc, manganese, boron, cobalt, molybdenum, all those are salts. And if you put them down immediately before you plant, so you can burn your plants. You know, if they're, you know, too much boron will cause bean leaves to turn white and get twisted and stuff like that. So that's the one to be careful with. And it's a very simple process doing this, especially for small gardens. Take your trace elements, whatever they are, copper sulfate, zinc sulfate, etc., and dissolve them in water. They should be soluble, and so you can just dissolve them simply in water. And as much water as it takes to dissolve as much trace elements as you're planning on applying, is how much water it takes. And mix into that trace element water, rich water, something like molasses or sugar or humates, some sort of a carbon source that will buffer it, and keep it from being a salt and leaching, and keep it from being a salt and burning. It'll bind with it and fold it in a form that makes it attractive for soil life protection. So my basic recipe is 3 parts carbon source to 10 parts minerals. So that would be 10 pounds of minerals, 3 pounds of a carbon source. If you're doing gardens, you're going to find that we need a 1/4 ounce of this and 2 ounces of that, probably, depending on the size of space you have. So it shouldn't be much of an issue. So simply dissolve it in water and then apply it evenly over the garden.
3 parts of carbon source and 10 parts of what?
Of your trace elements. So as an example, 10 pounds of copper sulfate, 3 pounds of water. Yes.
You said don't do it immediately. You said don't do it immediately before. Immediately meaning 2 weeks, 1 week, half hour?
The longer the better. If you do put it in water and dissolve it evenly with a carbon source, you can do it before you prepare the bed, before you plant. So, you know, put the minerals down in the morning, you know, prepare your bed and plant in the afternoon. You could do that. And ideally, you want as long as possible before. If you're just putting your trace elements down dry, you should wait at least a couple of weeks, ideally, you know, more than a month. But putting them in water and mixing them with a carbon source will reduce the need to be concerned about toxicity effects.
The carbon source is the molasses or sugar?
Yes. Oh. I personally use liquid humates. I find them to be superior, okay. But most humates are or can't get their hands on them. So molasses works fine. Yes.
I know stuff like boron, you can find a borax, but the other trace minerals, I forget if you mentioned where you could find them.
I wrote them all down in the handout last time.
Oh, where you can find
them. Yeah, the percent copper sulfate is 35% copper, cobalt sulfate is 26% cobalt.
But where do you find them?
Where do you find those things?
Yeah.
That's a good question. So I didn't talk about sourcing stuff much last year, last workshop. My basic suggestion is generally that you should go to our organizational website, and we've got lists of suppliers around the region of various materials, whether it's inoculants or minerals or compost or seed. If you look at our old newsletters, we've done articles, issues of the newsletter on compost and listed companies around that have this kind of stuff. It's bionutrient.org. That's our organizational website.
Among these suppliers, are there any who particularly cater to people who only need very small amounts, or for who, anyone in particular that would make it easier for people like us to?
I don't think we've got that properly delineated out. Our organizational objective is to facilitate local chapters similar to Weston Price Foundation, where you've got people who are, of like mind, who are trying to make this happen, and they can basically facilitate local depots. If you can get a 50-pound bag of copper sulfate for $100, that could serve, acres of community gardens. Some basic capacity to do that, I think is probably what needs to happen, because you just don't have good comprehensive sources of all this stuff readily available. So that's part of what we're trying to do with our organization is, say, okay, if this makes sense to you, why don't you, we'll try to help get people of like mind to coordinate together, to source materials, to find farms, everybody get a refractometer, 10 people get a refractometer, go to the farmer's market, and everybody buy a bunch of carrots, monitor which farm they were from, come and test them, and buy tomatoes and cucumbers and use your, there's words for that now, the crowdsourcing,
yes.
Things like that. You guys do that down there? Yeah. So you can figure out, is Whole Foods have better quality food or Trader Joe's? Which farms are the farmer's market? Which farmer's markets? Where do you find better crops? That's really, really, really important information for you. Through the process of actually just collecting it together and sharing it openly, we can empower everybody to do a better job. That makes sense. So I would say that's your long-term strategy, or even a short to medium-term strategy, because that's what we're rolling out organizationally right now. I know this course is not being put on by our organization, but certainly those who are interested, we do have membership forms over there and things like that. You can check out the website on the chapter leader project. Yes, Billy.
So we started planting,
yes.
And I want to pick up on what you said originally, because I felt we planted too early. It's just the nature of who we're working with.
Yes.
And starters have been started. So, and also they sent us stuff. So I'm sure we're not the only ones who got sent stuff early.
You have to put things in the ground already.
Say it again?
I think you've already put things in the ground.
Yeah, we put onions and asparagus plants in the mm-hmm. ground. I would have preferred to wait 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm using what I have in terms of the minerals and doing what we're trying to do. What do you do if people send you the stuff that you're ordering early? You're not in control of your starters.
If you are buying in seedlings in the mail, what a strange concept.
I'm not taking offense at that.
I really never conceived of this. I mean,
they came from Massachusetts.
Yeah, fair enough. It doesn't matter where it came from. Send it back, call them. Be clear with them what your deadlines are. If you need to warm up your soil, if it's like chickens and you have to order your chickens 2 months ahead,
right.
You know they're coming April 1st.
Right.
What I'm doing right now, what's going on in my garden right now, as of 2 days ago, is I've taken strips of old greenhouse plastic. People know what greenhouse plastic is. You can use any kind of a clear plastic and lay it on the ground, and it basically gives you the greenhouse effect in the soil. The thing to be concerned about is that the temperature right below that plastic may be up to 100 degrees. So you have to be a little bit careful on hot sunny days. You might be burning the life in the soil, frying them, literally. It's a great way to kill sod. But if you need to warm your soil temperature up, and you got some partly cloudy days in the 40s or 30s or something like that, it doesn't take more than a couple days to, really dramatically warm the soil.
Okay.
That's nice. Once you put your onions in, you aren't going to let the plastic down because it'll kill them. So, having some sort of a remay or something like that layer, wire through to the remay, would protect the plants, provide some of the insulating benefit. I always mulch my plant. I feel like that helps temperature in the soil. What you really want to have happening in the soil before you plant is life. And cold soil that's, been frozen all winter, there's not a lot of activity going on there. And if it's the life that feeds your plants, if you can warm up the soil and feed it a little bit, get the life going a little bit in that soil before you plant, you're going to be in much better shape. And that happens when the soil warms up.
I would say feed it a little bit.
Very good question. Feed it a little bit. I would use a little bit of molasses, a little bit of humates, a little bit of seawater, some sugar, some carbon, some minerals, and maybe some inoculants. And you can just water that into the soil. I'm talking 10 gallons per acre would be a heavy dose. So not really that much, one-to-one-to-one mix.
Yeah, and the life in the soil that's been frozen, does it survive the season, or does it get resettled in the air to the...
It slows down dramatically. It goes into, stasis, basically. Spore forms oftentimes, the sporulates, and basically it exceeds on this next generation, and then waits for the environment to be correct for those seeds to germinate, all that life to reawaken, the eggs to hatch. Yes.
Well, how would you recommend starting seedlings? I mean, like seed flats or peat pots or soil blocks or?
Yes. Which we started this. We talked about this last time.
But I'm sorry. Okay.
Doesn't hurt to review it. I generally am of the opinion, and we're sort of going nicely into the handout here. So let me just follow this line of conversation, and at some point we can just review the topics in the handout. We're going to cover most of them. We talked about potting soil. I said specifically, a lot of people, when they are starting their seedlings, have purchased this thing called sterile media. Ever seen a bag that says sterile media on it? And it's called, when people use it to start the seedling. Said, if it says sterile media, what they're doing is guaranteeing that it's dead. So that is exactly not the type of material you'd like to use to start your plants. You'd ideally like to use a nice, organically, certifiable, at least, compost-based potting soil. It's got a broad spectrum of minerals put into the compost pile. So you can usually get your hands on organic potting soil. They're around and about. You may have to go online to buy something. But I would suggest, ideally, you know what the soil test report would say for that potting soil and amend that accordingly. Make sure that your babies, when they're being born and they're in their early childhood development stage, are getting maximum nutrition. The first 3 or 4 weeks of the plant's life is like birth to kindergarten, right? It's critically important to feed your babies well early in life and give them a nice, balanced, healthy environment to start their lives off with. So ideally that means trays over cells. I personally think that in nature, when a seed germinates, it reaches its, feelers out and reads the environment. How down, what's down deep, what's across the profile, who am I living with? And when your seed germinates in a little cell that's this big or so, it reads a small environment. And so it's, I liken it to being, stuck in a crib. Until you're 6 years old, how would that do? How would your children be if they were never let out of the crib until they went to kindergarten? That's basically what you're doing to the plant when you're starting in little cells, and even in trays. At least trays that can reach out. So ideally, it would be a planting bed. Ideally, it would be a. What I've done at my house is I built a little sunroom in the front of the house. It's like 22 feet long and 14 feet deep, and about 14 feet in the top. And I just built a bed, a 22-foot-long bed that's 3 feet wide and 2 feet deep. Just a big garden bed, basically in the house. So you know, planting in something like that would be optimal, where the plants can basically be living in a soil environment and reach their roots out and really develop well. So the larger the pot, the better, basically, is the short answer. I would not do it with the seed, for sure. And, you know, that would be the basic process. Make sure that what after you plant, that you maintain moisture in the soil until the seed germinates. Absolutely crucial. Ideally, throughout the entire process, but if you ever let the soil dry out when the seed is germinating, that's extremely stressful for it. Let me see. How's that for basics?
Transplanting from your long bed,
yeah.
Where do you decide where to cut out?
The more space, the better. The bigger the fall, the better. Basically, the crucial thing is, this is the thing, you know, fantasy world is each plant has a foot and a half to start its life off, and then you take it, like, big, deep ball, and then that's less than half a year. So the most important thing is that you understand that you never want the top of the plant to be bigger than the roots. So you can see when the plants start to, you know, fill out and be bigger than their root ball, and there's no way that that root can anywhere near sit at the top. By the time that happens, you screwed your plants up. You screw them up. They're going to be screwed up the rest of their lives. It's a fait accompli. So generally, what that means practically is that you start your seedlings later and put them in smaller. I'd like to see the soil be more than I put them into the environmental conditions be optimal. People oftentimes put their seedlings in order they get all excited to spring seeds. They don't check basic things like soil temperature. You know, you get a warm few days and everything goes crazy. It's not yet time. You need to wait until the soil's warm, until the conditions are optimal. Help make it warm if you want, but that has to be in place. Generally you want the top growth to be smaller than the bottom growth. And as soon as you start to see the roots, get to that little root ball, you know, what do you call that? Root bound. Start to see the roots go around the inside of the pot. That's you're a week late. You don't want to see that happen. That's the most crucial thing with seedlings. Yes.
Well, I read that if you plant seeds directly into the ground, especially like, you know, earlier in the season, like now it's really hot, and you water them, you know, frequently, that every time you water, you make them colder, and that stresses them out. Is that only a problem if you have planted too early and your soil is just too cold in general and you shouldn't have planted?
I guess you could have ice cold water that you'd be, I suppose theoretically, water temperature certainly is important, and I've got a friend who gives these same courses, and he's been doing little experiments in his greenhouse, watering his seedlings with cold water, some with cold water, some with warm water, and the warm water seedlings grow faster. So there is some effect to that. Depends on if you got a little seedling tray or if you're in the soil itself.
Yeah, I'm talking about
in
the soil.
Yeah, I think probably I wouldn't be too concerned. I'd be more concerned about the nature of the water, what quality of water you're looking at. That's a big issue. So if you have chlorinated water, it's better to let it sit for 24 hours to let at least the chlorine off gas. And that process will probably warm the water up just by simply sitting, which will alleviate that problem.
What about hardening off seedlings? I read about you have to do it or else plants are going to get shocked. They're going to...
If you put a five-year-old out in a 40-degree night and say, it's good for you. Anybody? What would the effect on that five-year-old be? It's going to get sick. Right? They're gonna have a cold if they're still alive for the night, but that's gonna sap their energy. They're gonna be weak. So I mean, understand that you're basically caring for living organisms, and the same way you care for a child, understand where that plant is at in its life cycle and treat it accordingly. When your tomatoes are 6 feet tall and they've got 8 tomatoes on them or 10-15 tomatoes on them, they're pregnant mothers. Understand that they're pregnant mothers and they have a lot of needs, to stay balanced and stay healthy. And if they start to run out of what they need, they crash. Anybody ever had that experience? Seen that? Heard of it? Conceptually? Yes. So understand where the plants are at. I would suggest the hardening off is generally something people do with seedlings. They've grown too early sometimes, and they're ready to go out into the fields before the field is ready, before the nighttime temperatures are ready. And they're growing too fast, and if they keep growing fast, they'll, you know, get root bound, and then they'll be, you know, junk. And so they leave them out in the cold to slow down their growth, to shock their systems. I would suggest that's not optimal. It's a crisis management technique because you had bad planting.
So do you start late so when the weather's perfect and the soil's perfect, it doesn't have to be hard enough?
Exactly.
It just kind of.
If you start your seedlings a couple weeks later than they otherwise would, and put them in smaller than they otherwise would be, in more optimal conditions, you know, their roots are never going to have reached. They never kind of felt like they didn't have enough to grow. They're going to keep reaching out and growing.
Right.
When you want the plant just to get up and start growing and take off and never stop, you know, you want it to be balanced and strong and healthy and empowered and just, you know, and create that environment for it to flourish. You know, give it the best opportunity to manifest its inherent potential. Yes.
The amendment solution that you mentioned earlier, the humates or molasses, whatever. Okay, so let's say you have 6 inches of hay mulch.
Yeah.
And so what do you just pour it through?
Yeah.
You don't try to pull it away.
Depends on how much water you're using. You've got six inches of hay mulch right before you plant.
Right.
So you're going to pull the soil, you're going to pull the mulch away to plant.
Right.
Depending on what that hay mulch is doing, it may be cooling off your soil early in the spring.
Right, that's another issue, with keeping it colder. Yeah.
So, what would I do? Theoretically, I would pull the hay mulch off, water the goodies in, put the mulch back in, put a piece of plastic on top.
Okay.
And that would, basically, you don't want, I mean, the soil life is not going to establish until the soil warms up. If the soil is not at 50 degrees, the soil life is not going to engage.
Okay.
It's just a simple fact. They like it 70 degrees like we do. It's too cold for them. It's too cold for your plants. Everybody's just sitting there and shivering until the environment's better.
Okay.
So you can take responsibility for managing the environment to some extent. Yes?
Are you creating new soil life every year then? I mean, or is it just dormant?
Ideally, it's established and it reawakens every year.
Okay.
Yes.
So it's just like hibernating.
Effectively, it is. Yeah. And the warmer you can keep the soil, you know, if you can keep plants growing in that environment, they'll stay alive. They won't necessarily hibernate. Their life cycle is determined by their environmental conditions. So the colder the soil gets, the more they shut down. The warmer they shut down. Yes.
Also, last time we just touched on those of us who only have a windowsill.
Yes.
And just talking about what's the best medium for growing plants indoors. And I don't think we got in too far with that.
We didn't, because I said I didn't have a recipe and I would come back to you with one. So, and I've been harassing the guy who answers all my hard questions, and he has not gotten it back to me, although he has promised to.
Okay. So maybe
by
10 or 11.
He's somewhat religious. This is a, you know.
So maybe we'll
Christian
see it on your website.
I would like to, when I get it, forward to fill up and have an email to everyone. Sorry, I don't have to say.
This is not something you'd be putting in an email?
I suppose we could. See, formally, you guys are not connected to the organization at this point. Some of you are, but through joining this course, you're not going to get our newsletters. You're not going to. So I don't know if it's okay to people. If you don't want to get newsletters from us, tell Philip, and otherwise we'll be able to give you the email list and we'll push you on our newsletter. We go send out e-newsletters about once a month, ideally. So, yes. I guess we can put it out there. But I think that'd be great. That's a good idea. I hadn't thought of it.
Okay.
Sure. Okay. Good. The room is filled out here in the last half hour.
Who's the list of amendments again? Molasses, seawater?
If you want to work on the soil, I said, molasses, seawater, and pH.
And some inoculants.
And some inoculants or enzymes would be certainly good. Inoculants or enzymes, so spores of bacterial and fungal families that you want to have established in the soil. Inoculants.
Molasses, seawater,
humates. Humates. Humates are they are in the found in the geological profile between peat moss and coal. It's soft coal. It's called leonardite. It's got about 85 on average percent pure humus, that which makes soil black, real stable organic matter with a half life of hundreds of years, as opposed to mulch or compost, which is a half a percent. Compost is usually about a half a percent humus. It's mostly organic matter that will oxidize and turn into carbon dioxide, which is usually what happens to it.
How it's dry?
Mm-hmm. Dry humates.
How much, I know it's really concentrated, so how much would I put? Like you said, 10 gallons per acre of your...
Of your mix, one to one. So a pound of humates, a pound of seawater, a pound of molasses, get it all in separate water. If you get humates in chunk form, it's not going to do any good. You need to crush them. So if you got a mortar and pestle or you got a cement floor somewhere and a big piece of metal, just go, it doesn't take long, just crush them in the bottom. Yes?
You were talking about crop rotation, and I know the families, you want to rotate sort of in a certain order where this one will give to this one the next season and the next season. So if you at the end of that cycle, would you retest the soil or you add all your nutrients to that area, to that just that one area every...
I don't practice crop rotation. I don't think it's necessary. I think the only rationale for crop rotation is because you're concerned about pest and disease pressure. And as far as I'm concerned, if you've got pest and disease pressure, you don't have a community, an environmental condition where your plants can thrive. And if you've got a healthy soil, your plants will, by the very nature of being healthy, be resistant to pest and disease, and it's not an issue.
So you retest the soil every year?
I would say for the first 3 or 4 years, you test the soil once a year, and you figure out what your maximum application rates are, of things are that you need, and address them. Generally, depending on where you stand, you can do about 85% of your systemic mineral addressing in year one. 5 or 10% in year two, and the last 5% may take you a couple of years. With very, very small quantities. But, that would be my suggestion. My understanding is that each plant family has a certain, what we can call it gut flora, has a certain set of species that in its intestinal tract that it uses to digest its food, which is the life in the soil, digesting the minerals in the soil. And so if you establish healthy tomato gut flora in this environment, I don't see a reason why you need to move your tomatoes out of that environment. I think that perhaps next generation would be even healthier. If those seeds fell in that soil where the parents were healthy, they would germinate with great vigor and vitality. So I don't think that rotation is necessary. I would suggest it's a mechanism for attempting to manage deficiencies, which doesn't actually solve the problem.
Follow-up question is, please. You didn't get your soil tested. You still want to grow those tomatoes this year.
Yes.
You're kind of stuck.
Get your soil tested.
Right.
And you put your minerals in and follow good practices.
Even now you could put your minerals in? Oh, I thought spring was not a good time to put them in.
It's not the best time.
Okay.
The fall is the best time. The first thing I said today was you can still do it now. Get out there and do it.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Dan, what were those percentages you just said? Year one, year two, year three?
I'm just ballparking. I said 85% year one.
Oh, okay.
85%. It depends on how bad your soil is.
Okay.
But you can usually do most of what you need to address systemic deficiencies in the first year.
Okay.
If you want to, put your energy into it.
Okay.
And I said 5 or 10%, and then the last 5% will take a while.
So depending on what you're growing, say you're growing broccoli or corn or something, yeah, you're taking out nutrients from the soil through the process of growing the plant. So what are you doing to make sure that the right nutrients are back?
My general practice is to take my soil test in the fall, address my deficiencies, and in the spring before I plant, I put down a basic crop fertilizer, which is, 100 pounds of rock phosphate, 100 pounds of green sand, et cetera, et cetera. I'll give you the recipe as part of the agenda here today. But the basic practice is I do about 1,000 pounds per acre of basic rock minerals and stuff together on an annual basis to just keep it all safe. And then I just hold this spray to move it.
About, you know, this crop takes more of this out here versus this kind of...
In life, if you have a well-functioning system, you build soil. That this is how you... This is the answer to the, you know, I've only got 6 inches of topsoil. So I think I drew the picture last time with photosynthesis and the leaves, you know, the sugars being fed down out through the roots to be the soil life. I said that the healthy plant will exude between 60 and 70% of the sugar it manufactures out through the roots to the soil life. And that soil life then, you know, uses that sugar to reproduce, to eat, to grow, to go through the biological process. And when they die, the bacteria and the fungi die, they build soil. That is the foundation. From my perspective, this is how you build soil, is by building life in the soil, which goes through its natural process, and if it's not disturbed, if it's not tilled, can just build up over time. So that would be my systemic solution. For how to build. So it's what nature does. It's how the prairies are built, right? 40 feet deep of topsoil in Illinois. How did it get there? It was the organic matter from the plants just cycling and cycling and cycling, and it just built this soil.
The humates, they're minerals. How do you get them to not settle to the bottom of the bucket that you're using?
Depending on it's part of the size, basically. I buy liquid humates. I buy them from a guy who crushes them up into 3 microns, and they just stand in suspension. It's just like, you know, black water. That's what it looks like. If you put some black paint in water, it just looks like that. So it's part of the slide, so that's why I have to crush it. Ideally, you buy powdered humates. You can easily buy liquid humates. If you're going to buy them anyways, for this purpose, buy liquid. They're a little more expensive. But if you buy a 50-pound bag of powdered humates, you can effectively get that same thing done yourself for cheaper. Yes.
Just a quick question. You said that you put about 1,000 pounds per acre of rock phosphates and other types of rock minerals basically every year without fail. I guess my question is, do you ever? It's been my experience I'm new at this stuff and learning a lot, but it seems like it's possible to put too much. Mm-hmm. And so, do you ever adjust that 1,000 pounds based on any soil tests that you find, or is it just like overall?
I'll give you a basic recipe. I don't do it without fail. And it's done as a part of the process of building that vitality in the soil. I suggest that when your soil life is actually functioning well, that you should not need to add anything to your soil.
Okay.
That it should, you know, you should be able to cycle very nicely for a very long period of time.
So that kind of thing is what you do at the beginning of building.
Yeah. Once your soil tests, you know, basic deficiencies are addressed, but you feel like your system's not going well enough and you really want to, you know, supplement and keep supported, this is a good management practice. It's a crush.
Okay.
It's a, you know, 3 to 5 years, depending on your time frame and how well you're functioning.
Okay.
You should be able to wean yourself on it entirely.
Okay.
And then you should be down to foliar sprays, which is, you know, 10 gallons of minerals per acre per year. I think foliar sprays are going to be beneficial. Once everything is well functioning, they can really just sort of keep it topped off very nicely.
Okay.
But that would be my long-term strategy.
Good question.
This was again something we covered last time, but basically you take a 6-inch profile, multiple sites, and mix the samples, pull out a pound, and send that into the lab. And I've got forms over there, surface forms, if you'd like to do that. What to put on now for the season? We will talk about for the season now as we move into the next. As I start to run through the handout here, the target for aluminum is less than 200 ppm. And most people who are growing in soil have a pretty high, like over 1,000 or so. As you build life and vitality in your soil, you will see the aluminum level drop off as the soil life complexes it and ties it up. So it's not going away necessarily, it's just not available anymore. That's what you want to see. So below 200 on aluminum is your target, and you want to watch that over time and see it moving down, hopefully. If you're using a very compost-based growing media, you may not have high aluminum because you're having soil that compost. Iron is generally twice manganese. So if manganese is 80 or 90, then iron is 160 to 180. Generally, my experience, at least dealing with soil, is that your iron levels are more than twice your manganese levels, so it doesn't matter. What you need to do is be building your manganese levels for the foreseeable future.
For the aluminum, and you're seeing the ppm go down, is that only with that particular method?
With that specific acid.
Okay, so yes, they're not actually pulling out the aluminum from the...
Yes, they're fixing it and making it biologically unavailable. Yeah.
And I guess what I'm saying is when it's biologically unavailable, it's not going to show up on the test.
Specifically, even though it's still there. Yes. Your soil, like, you know, bare subsoil is made out of iron and aluminum and silicon. It's like 97% of your soil, actual soil, is iron and aluminum and silicon. That's what your clay colloid is made out of. That's what your sand particle is made out of. Those three minerals, basically. Okay. Building soil, aluminum, iron. Why to mineralize in the fall? Why do you want to mineralize in the fall specifically? Because you want to facilitate the digestion of the minerals. If you're talking about using rocks, rock phosphate, limestone, gypsum, green sand, these are all rocks. If you're talking about using rocks to address systemic deficiencies, they must be digested, taken from a crystalline form to a protoplasmic form before they're available for your plants. And that process takes time, which is why the best way to apply your minerals is into your compost pile. The best way to apply minerals is into your compost pile when you're building it, and when that compost pile is done, you will have, you know, very good levels of very nicely available minerals for your plants to use to build their bodies with. Okay. And if you're just using compost, I would use some stone dust. I would use some, some basalt or something like that. You can use azomite if that's available to you. Dynamin is another product. You don't need to use a lot, but it would be good to have at least a pound of various minerals in your potting soil per cubic foot, I would say. Depending on what your soil test says, you may want to add some limestone or some green sand or some rock phosphate or some gypsum into your compost. And even the trace elements, but ideally at least a pound of rock minerals per cubic foot of potting soil, of your growing media, if that's compost, and give it some heft and some base to work with, if that makes sense. All right. I think that was all the questions here. So that was very nice. Let's just all start working through the outline here. That's a much longer outline this time than we did last time. So the objective of the course here today is to walk you through the growing season, to say, okay, now it's March, almost April, now what am I supposed to be doing, and how we walk, through systemically, step by step, May, June, July, transplanting, irrigating, plant visual analysis, looking at the plants, reading the plants, foliar sprays, bricks, conductivity, etc. What are some good basic management practices that you can use going through the season? How do you discern? How do you figure out what's going wrong and address it? And then hopefully the last sort of hour and a half, we'll go through people that I consider to be seminal thinkers and whose perspectives expand our understanding. So that's the basic agenda for the day. Outline. We've reviewed your experiences so far, questions and answers. So basically down to the bottom of page one, reducing limiting factors. This is my, this is your little checklist of things you want to, ideally be doing as many as you possibly can to create the reality where your plants are going to flourish. So first step there in the early childhood development stage is seed soak. I didn't talk about this last time. That's something you can certainly do with all your seeds. It's easy to do with your larger seeds, including corn, peas, beans, beets, some of the squashes that have bigger seeds. This is easier to do with. So things like lettuce and broccoli, it's going to be harder. But basically what I suggest you do is between 4 and 12 hours before you plant your seed, you take and you put it in water with a mixture of a little bit of seawater and a little bit of kelp. And that will give the seed all of the minerals and enzymes and growth hormones it needs to really germinate very nicely.
Seawater and what?
And kelp. So I generally say 1% seawater and 4% kelp. And 95% water.
What about the inoculant? What if you could you use that? If you're dusting your seeds and then putting them in the water?
If you're going to be soaking your seeds, ideally you put your inoculant on after you soak them. In this case, it's okay depending on how long you keep the water there for. But you're going to be washing off a lot of the inoculants by putting the seeds in the water. If you're going to be doing this, ideally you inoculate after you soak the seeds. But soak them for a few hours until they start to expand, and then take them and plant them in your soil, whether it's out in the garden or in the pots in the hoop house or the greenhouse.
When you gave the description of seeds, you went from one change to the other, you went from that to corn seeds, but what about tomatoes?
Somewhere in the middle. Basically, the issue is that when they're wet, they'll stick together.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so you have to, it's a pain in the butt to plant seeds that are all sticking together. So what you have to do is you need to, in the case of the smaller seed, pour the water out and then just let them sit on it like a paper towel or something, or a cloth, until they are dry enough to, to not stick together. It definitely makes it a little more work, but you can be, talking to them and, telling them how you're going to take care of them and how much you love them while you do it, and that probably would not be a bad thing at all. So certainly if you've got a small garden, if you've got, time to do things like that, that's always very good.
So all seeds, right?
Ideally.
Okay.
But, you think about lettuce seeds.
Yeah, I know.
Right.
That's
what I'm
thinking about.
Yeah.
Where do you buy the seawater and the kelp and the salt? Or where do you get them?
Wherever you get fertilizers and things like that. Right. Online, you can certainly find stuff. Seawater can be made out of sea salt and add water, right? Or you can just hop over the bridge and down to the edge of the water and get yourself a little sample. I would prefer it, be pure, clean sea water, not from New York Harbor, but. take that into consideration. Himalayan sea salt, whatever. Rehydrated, basically. Okay, is there another question? I thought there was a question back there.
No.
Oh, okay.
Wait,
cool.
For the seawater?
Yes.
So sea salt and just water is enough? Like it's not like some special fish mineral or something that's in the seawater?
There is some, there's a lot of life that's in seawater, a lot of basic, single-celled organisms. They say there's more life per square cubic inch of seawater than there is in a cubic inch of soil. It's actually more life per unit volume in seawater than there is in soil. So you're not going to be necessarily getting all that back, but you'll get a lot of the benefit of the trace elements by adding sea salt to water, which is the elements. And the kelp, you're going to be getting a lot of growth hormones and enzymes, sort of plant biostimulants.
Is there a ratio for sea salt and water?
I don't know. Never tried doing it.
But it shouldn't just be there's some of the things called sea salt that are really just sort of mass-produced and wouldn't have as many trace minerals. Isn't that right?
If it's actually sea salt, if it's actually seawater that got dried out into salt and they, pulverized it, it should have the trace elements in it. It's the iodized salt that doesn't have the trace elements. They take all the trace elements out, and they, so down to pure sodium chloride and they add iodine, which is one mineral of 90 that's in seawater and sea salt.
There's actually people in Brooklyn that are making
sea salt, like local sea salt.
Yeah. I would raise it quite a few guys at the lake.
But they go way up. They don't just get it right, you know, on the shore. They try that. It's disgusting.
Yeah.
They go way up. Yeah.
Good. Well, in that case, I would definitely support them.
One thing I do know, I know some things that say sea salt, just to get to your question, sir,
yeah.
They are refined.
Yeah.
So, yeah, fine one.
Know your source, as usual. Don't be a, you know, blind consumer and trust the labeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Support local business.
There's a store in Hudson Street called The Meadow, and they have a website, and they have like 100 different types of salt. And,
I'm sure there's plenty of places.
You know, all sorts of...
Brooklyn is making sea salt.
Brooklyn is, yeah.
The water they pull in before they turn it into sea salt.
I'm sorry, what?
The guys from Brooklyn that are going out and harvesting seawater take the water before they turn it into sea salt.
Right, and they dry it on their...
On the rooftop.
Which makes you wonder what's going in with the air.
Besides,
but never mind that.
Electromagnetic dissonance.
Love the city, don't you?
I'll try to see.
Salt place on Hudson.
The Meadow.
Oh, Dan,
yeah. Could you tell me the name of the Brooklyn people?
I was told by.
I'll look it up. I can look it up.
Expert nutritionist. That,
yeah.
That's the cleanest one.
People seem to think it's a good thing, unless you have some marketing or what. But yeah.
What's the best one? Himalayan.
It's the most well-marketed for sure. There's Celtic sea salt. There's C90. If you buy C90, it's straight out of... It's really, really clean seawater from the Gulf of... What is it? Baja, California. It's like $30 for a 50-pound bag. Anybody that want to pay, you know, top dollar for sea salt, get a 50-pound bag of C90. SEA-90.
Isn't that the amendment? Or that's what they use as an...
It's a soil amendment.
Yeah,
I highly recommend it.
Yeah.
I put 50 pounds of that in my fertilizer every year. Great.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Good stuff.
Can we be too... I know it's possible for too much salt. How do we make sure... same thing, just use a soil test.
50 pounds per acre of sea salt per year is not a lot.
Okay.
You know, a ton per acre would be, you know, too salt much. In the sea salt. Field of
crutch. All right. And if we're going to do it in a potting mix, we should just be very careful because it's...
We'll talk about the soil conductivity meter as we come down shortly here in the agenda.
Okay.
Basically, if you want to be empirical, there's a really simple tool you should be using anyways that will give you good guidance.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so seed soaking, seed inoculation, we talked about that last time. Potting soil minerals, I just talked about that. Biological activity, I've basically been talking about that as well, how to get the biological activity going through, soil temperature and moisture and all those environmental conditions, ideally you're putting inoculants in too, feeding them. Temperature of soil and air, I talked about that. Does anybody have any questions on these topics as I run through them here?
Oh, Dan, after you dry the seeds off on the cloth, then do you put the inoculant on?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Or you can put the inoculant on after you pour the water off.
Okay.
All in the cloth.
Okay.
You don't want to dry them out too much. You don't want to dry them out so much that they stop expanding and germinating.
Okay.
Just enough so they can be just enough.
Okay.
So, you know, you can separate them out. Yes.
Can you recommend a good model of soil thermometer?
A good model of soil thermometer? I don't think it matters. As long as it gets deep temperature, you can get stuff for $2, $5. Yeah, price.
So I only use the pot at home to handle the plants, but should I, because I buy the soy, from Home Depot.
In the store, yeah.
So should I test the soil anyway?
If that's the soil you're growing your plants in, absolutely.
Okay.
You want to know what's not in there.
Okay.
And you want to make sure that it is in there, because otherwise it won't be in your plants, it won't be in here. So, yeah. If you're going to buy a soil from a big box store like that, it certainly has. Whatever your media is you're working with, you want to know what's in it and what's not in it.
The inoculants, last time you had mentioned that there was one inoculant that you use for... I understand that all your different plants.
Yeah.
There are most online that some people are differentiating their inoculants.
Right.
On a per plant basis.
Yes. What I generally suggest is, if you go into microbiology, it's very easy to be profoundly overwhelmed. I mean, it's a bunch of Latin, and this is like, what does this all mean? It's a full-on research project to begin to understand what you're doing. And if you want to do that, great. But for me, you know, I looked for a company who's done, you know, seems to have a good reputation, who's put together something simple and comprehensive. It, inexpensive, comprehensive, simple. The stuff is, it does not cost a lot of money to manufacture the stuff, right? I mean, if it's a good company, they can do a good job making a high-quality product and not charging much. So basically, I would look for, and the thing is, if you have a certain family of species that does not set up symbiotic relationships with the crop plants you're growing, they just won't get fed and they won't thrive in that environment. So I'm not concerned about putting in some scores of things that aren't going to work with my cucumbers because it's not going to be a detriment. It's not going to set up a negative effect. Okay? Yes.
Is it then reasonable to say a good rule of thumb is the more types of organisms in the inoculum?
Basically, families, looking for different families of bacteria and fungi. So we want, you know, 30 families of bacteria, 10 families of fungi, that'd be great. You know, if you can find 8 and 4, I mean, that's better than most products in the market. That's the concept. Yeah. Okay. Temperature, soil, and air, water access. I've said it before, I'm going to say it again. If you cannot maintain hydration, don't waste your money on minerals. Ever hear that? If you cannot maintain hydration, if you cannot maintain hydration, that means like continuously through the entire growing season. If you cannot maintain hydration, don't waste your money on minerals. You must have water in the soil for the life to live and thereby do its work of solubilizing minerals and digesting them and feeding them to your plants.
Every 2 days, every 5 days.
That means you must maintain hydration, which means you have to stick your hand down there in the soil and pick up a handful of it and see whether it's wet or not, moist or not.
Is it potassium chloride in water? Is it bad, good, neutral?
Potassium chloride.
Potassium chloride.
Soft and water softener. I would say that could be desert.
Potassium?
Chlorine.
Not sodium, potassium.
Chloride. It's the chlorine that's the issue. Chlorine is used to kill biology. Right, you use chlorine to the reason they chlorinate water is to make it so it's dead, right? Because they've got all this bad management with the water, so it's toxic unless they kill it. You hear about that? Yeah.
Hard water good?
Hard water is better. I mean, you know, rainwater is generally good. You know, stream water. It depends on the environmental conditions. A nice clean well water would be good, but you have access to. If you've got tap water, that's all you've got access to, they're going to have to put at least chlorine into it, and probably chlorine, which is, you know, bad.
It's well water. But it's hard.
And so it's hard water is fine. In your case, if you've got hard water, you're in Vermont, not like the rest of these guys. In Vermont, hard water is fine. Yes. I would not use softened water that still has traces of the chlorine in it. Those minerals in the hard water, you can get calcium in there, you can get, you know, magnesium in there, which are all things your soil test is going to say your soil needs anyways. So you can actually get free minerals from your water. Just match up, test your water, test your soil, see what the imbalances are, and then test accordingly. But chlorine is something I would not want to have my water at all possible. Yes.
To maintain hydration, if you use drip irrigation on a field, is there a danger that you're going to overhydrate the plants, or pretty much you just let that go?
By using any form of irrigation.
So I guess what I'm saying is,
If it's muddy, it's too much.
Sure.
Yeah, if it's wet,
but if it's not muddy, if it just sort of stays constantly a little bit moist or wet, could that be too much?
What you want.
Okay.
And it's a feel thing. I can't tell you.
Sure. Because wet, you could be drowning. They won't absorb oxygen. Then.
Exactly. There will be no oxygen in the soil if it's wet. Okay. Yeah, you want to maintain moisture. And one of the best ways to do that, besides, I find drip tape to be very, very good, very inexpensive, very practical technology. You can turn it on. You can leave it on a timer. You know, and the timer will automatically operate, hook up to a hose. If you've got a hose, you can have a tank. And just, you know, have a timer, you know, open it up and close it if you've got a water catchment system. But the best thing to do is to be out there and to monitor the soil. And, you know, if you're going to use drip tape, the thing I would say is that you should have a line of drip every foot or 18 inches probably. Because what happens is if you just put a line of drip tape down the middle of the bed, it's wet for that, you know, 1 foot or 18 inches wide as it percolates down, but the whole rest of the, you know, 5 foot area between center to center in the bed is dry. Everybody had that experience? Your pathway is bone dry in the middle of summer? Ideally, a big healthy plant has roots that are reaching out and meeting each other in the middle, right? And if you don't have water in that soil, you don't have life in that soil, that plant is not, does not have access to that soil to grow from. So I, what I do is I plant, I put my drip tape down, and I mulch. And then I'm in a really good position. I don't have to weed. I'm feeding my soil. I'm keeping the soil, you know, protected and covered. I'm keeping the soil moist. It, for me, it feels like a really good strategy.
So you mulch with plastic or with hay?
Plastic.
No. Okay.
No, I use hay mulch.
Okay.
Mulch hay, formerly, which probably you can't find in the corner store here. But,
I have a question. I have to water in the summer. I water this garden like 10,000 square feet potted plants on a roof.
Okay.
Just city water.
In so, little pots?
Oh, well, some of them are massive.
Big pots, okay.
And really old trees. So mm-hmm. I'm basically slowly slaughtering them if I'm putting city water on them, right? I mean, what can I do?
They sell filter.
What can I do?
There's an accent for you, finally. Everybody's what can I do? You can let them. Kentucky accent.
I know that.
I would put my water in a tank. I would fill up the tank at night, 10 p.m. or 8 p.m. after the sun's gone down, and let it sit all night long. And let the water warm up, let the chlorine off gas, and then I would, you know, open it up in the morning. If you had a tank with a valve on the bottom that was running the drip tape, you could just simply open it up and come back in an hour and close it again.
You can buy chlorine removing filters for gardening, you know, for water hoses too.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you can use, I mean, a carbon filter is probably going to be better.
Sure.
But that's expensive, depending on how much water you're running through, right? Because as soon as the carbon filter fills up, it's not taking chlorine out anymore. So there's numerous ways to do these things, but you certainly have environmental conditions around here.
Okay, Dan, I have a special problem because of this keeping it hydrated.
Yeah.
I just cannot. If a drought comes, I don't have my well isn't enough to mm-hmm. keep it. So. Yeah. Since the last workshop, I've been trying to figure out what to do.
Yeah.
And one thought is to concentrate on a couple of beds and mm-hmm. keep those wet, which I know I can do.
Mm-hmm.
And but in terms of, okay, so let's say you put all these minerals in, then that bed dries up and microbes are dead.
Mm-hmm.
But do you still have, like, what about next year? You know, hope springs eternal.
Yeah, generally, you know, after, what do they say? Specifically, as soon as your soil dries up, your potassium availability will drop off in 2 to 3 months. It's, you know, as soon as the soil dries up, potassium levels go like this.
Okay.
And then as soon as it is moist again, they begin to slowly creep up. So
okay. It's
a series of, you know, chemical, biochemical, you know, biophysical reactions that are going on and basically not going on.
Okay.
So, yes, I mean, that's in most people's cases, they get a nice drought in, you know, July.
Right.
You know, end of June through the beginning of August, it's hot and dry, and a lot of the soils dry up, and a lot of the plants start to crash. They go from a nice, glossy, you know, sheen of the leaf down through dull and discolored to infested disease and death. And
I get crops, though.
Right.
You know.
So it's a slow progression.
Yeah.
And depending on, you know, how bad it was this year and how well you were able to keep them moist, they
right.
may, you know, they come back to life. Oftentimes, you know, by September, late September, October, things are looking gorgeous again.
Right.
Right? I mean, 2 months ago, it started raining again. The soil moistened up and the life is going back into the soil. So you have this mid-summer, late-summer doldrums where it's too dry and everything shuts down. And it takes a while to get back from it. And if you can understand that and do your best to minimize it, That's good strategy. Mulching is a masterful thing to do.
Okay.
You can really keep water going a lot longer if you mulch.
Okay, but basically, see, I'm thinking, okay, let's say I put money into putting minerals in.
Yeah.
Then are they available for the following year?
Of course.
Okay.
Yes.
And then the microbes have to start up all over again.
But they've already started digesting them. I mean, once they, okay. I mean, as long as the microbial activity is going on in the soil, you've got that process.
No, I mean, let's say a bed goes completely dry.
Yeah.
Which sometimes I have to let some people go.
Okay. So when that gets moistened back up again, it'll pick up, you know, where it left off.
Okay.
It's back to zero.
Okay. That's what I want.
The spores are going to be there. The minerals are going to be there. The minerals are going to be partially digested.
All right.
Yeah.
And but the pot issue, you know, if people have to grow in pots,
yeah.
What about the roots reaching the edges of the pots?
The bigger the pot, the bigger the plant, the healthier the plants.
Okay.
I mean, if you want to have a nice 10-foot, 15-foot tall tomato plant that's healthy, you know, you can't put it in a little pot like this.
Okay.
You got to put it in a big pot. The more soil, the better.
Okay.
Yes.
I know. For urban farmers, it's really hard to get hay brought in because it's so expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking if I just grew, like, oats and peas in that spring and then use that as mulch, is that, like...
If you guys would talk to each other a little bit and strategize and coordinate, you'd realize that a nice 3-hour drive away is, you know, ridiculous quantities of remarkably inexpensive hay. And, you know, I mean, just pool your resources... You know, rent a truck, get out there, you know, spend $150 on hay, and you got so much you can't, you know, it's gratuitous. You have to coordinate. If we start working together, we can do this whole resource management thing, and we can get everybody, you know, in bulk quantities, you know, at commodity prices of critical components. We need certain things to build our soil, and it's not like they're not available, it's just that we haven't got the, you know, supply chain distribution thing going on.
The New York Times had an article. There's a woman in Brooklyn who has workshops on growing in bales of hay when you don't have any soil, and she might, you know, be able to. And I think part of the thing was that she had a way of buying hay.
Craigslist.
You know.
Just do Craigslist and look in New York State. You got how many different Craigslists in New York State? You got 15, 20 of them. Figure out which county you want to go into. Go to the farm section. Type in hay. I mean, you want to do a 50-mile radius, a 100-mile radius, a 200-mile radius. It's all right there. There's tons of it. They're looking to get rid of it. They got tons of hay land, and the dairies are all going under. You know, and a lot of them don't have. They just got 10,000 bales sitting in the barn. Don't know what to do with it. Give them a reasonable offer, and they'll happily part with it.
I have two quick questions. Okay.
Yeah.
On the tape distribution, where do you put it on the sort of the between where you plant, or do you put it much closer to the root on the plant?
I would have, like I said, one every 12 to 18 inches.
And the plant is in the middle.
Sure. Start with one in the middle, with where the plant is. And then as that gets established, turn that one off.
Right.
And turn on the two that are 1 foot away.
Oh, okay.
And that'll inspire the roots to reach out and put some minerals to it. And once you feel like the root system is out that far, turn those two off. And turn two more on that are farther out.
How clever. And the
I won't tell you who I heard that from.
The horse,
they were growing.
The hay. how do you feel about hay that's got like manure bedding in it from horses or something like that? Would that be something that you would not want to use?
I would be careful of. I mean, generally manure is better composted than fresh applied. If you're growing certified organic, basically you cannot use fresh manure.
But if you pick that up from a farmer, a horse, and then compost it,
yes.
That would be fabulous.
Unless they
healthy.
Had in the hay pest herbicide residue that will tweak your tomato plants.
Right.
I mean, it's a big issue for a lot of people taking specifically horse bedding. Is the persistent herbicides that were used to grow the bed that stay in the that are on the straw that make it through the composting process are in your garden.
That would be true with any hay, then you have to watch them.
Anything, but
especially horse hay.
Well, it because horse people are finicky and they are willing to pay top dollar for totally clean hay with no weeds and anything else in it. Mulch hay. I mean, $2 a bale, $3 a bale, right? And you shouldn't have to pay more than $3 a bale. I pay $1 a bale.
Is food. Here, it's a little bit more, but yeah, it's not. It's like maybe 5 or 7.
If you took a little bit of drive out of the city,
right.
You could really get to like a $3 available head. No problem. You shouldn't be paying more because they're getting
to. Only when it's here, yeah.
Yeah.
So what are you doing with the opposite problem when you have downpours and a lot of rain? Are you protecting?
When I have downpours and lots of rain, I have raised beds. I have a field of an acre with basically a trench going through it every 4 feet, which I call a pathway. I use my tractor with a bed former to basically flip up the soil on both sides of the bed and make a trench that I walk in. And there's a slight incline to my field, so if I get a, was it Irene and, what was it, Rita? Irene and Rita? Whatever it was a year and a half ago, we got, 12 inches of rain in a 9-day span, and I had planted my baby salad greens after Irene, before Rita, and they germinated right up through there, didn't get washed out, took off and grew. I was, 3 weeks after Rita, I was picking salad greens that I seeded into that downpour, that deluge. And I had rivers running through the garden. Every 4 feet was a river of water running through. So I would say raised beds and drip tape. Are a great systemic, proactive position for drought and flood. Expect at least one, if not both, every growing season from groundwater. Right? And prepare for it. It's just good proactive management. Yes.
You're going back to the hay?
Yes.
I've been looking for hay. Like I'm trying to find a Craigslist up in Hudson Valley.
Yeah.
My question is, okay, we ask a farmer because we want to get something that doesn't have any pesticides in it, ideally grown organic.
Yeah.
What are the questions we should be asking the farmers when we ask them? Because obviously they want to get rid of the hay.
Ask them what they put on the field. And rarely are you going to have anybody doing any kind of a side. They're not going to be doing pesticides, herbicides, fungicides on hay.
Right.
They're going to be probably putting down some 10-10-10 or some,
right.
Cattle manure or something like that. But, there's not enough money in hay to make it worthwhile spraying all that stuff. So I wouldn't, it's generally going to be fairly clean. And it's probably better to get hay that doesn't have anything on it than something that has chemicals on it, sort of chemical fertilizer. But, hay is rich in minerals. It's a heavier feeder than corn. If you want to take a farm and just wear it out, just hay it. If you hay a field for 10, 15, 20 years, you will just wear out the soil because it's a good, strong feeder, and it contains in its body a lot of nutrition. So you're actually feeding your soil literally. I think it's 12 pounds of minerals for every 100 pounds of hay or something. It's a really high mineral content. So, yeah, I would say less is more.
And is there a crop? Is there a specific grain that we should do better than others?
Hay is not straw.
Right.
So hay is just...
But don't get too good hay.
Straw is going to be more expensive for starters.
Yeah.
And it's more likely to have chemicals used to grow it.
Yeah.
Hay has much... It's got multiple families of plants in there. It's got, from my perspective, it's much more valuable material. The only issue with hay is weed seeds, which some people get concerned about. I find my weed population is dramatically down after mulching. My weed pressure, my time spent weeding, is now remarkably less than it was before I was mulching so heavily. So that's just my practical experience.
So if you have straw already, it's fine.
It's fine. It's just, but you're probably paying $8 a bale for it or something, and you can pay $2.50. And if you've got a garden that's 100 square feet, you can find another deal. But if you actually want to do 1,000 square feet or something like that, if you have the access to the space, cost becomes an issue.
Approximately how much straw or hay or whatever how deeply do you mulch?
Till I can barely see my seedlings.
Okay.
Which is usually 4 or 6 inches.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like a nice, till it feels like enough. It should be like like a bed. It should be soft and fluffy and basically when I get done planting, I can't see anything but hay.
Okay.
All I can see, there's a little green head every here and there, but they're hard to see. And you put them to bed. It's like putting them to bed, and they're all in. They're warm. They're cozy. They're fed, and they just and you don't have to do any work from there on out. So you can keep the soil moist and foliar spray every now and then until you're picking. It's great fun. All right. So moving along here, water access, spacing. I'm going to just sort of fly in the face of John Jevons here for those who have studied him. My perspective is that, I'll start this way. Anybody gone for a walk in the forest recently? Remember having gone for a walk in the forest? Okay, I'm thinking about a type of forest where the trees are a little too close together. It's not a park forest. It's a little bit of a you know, thicket. Maybe you've got maybe 30-year-old trees or 40-year-old trees, bigger oak trees, and one every 10 or 15 feet. Yes.
Sorry, I live in a forest in Manhattan.
Yes.
It's old growth forest.
Beautiful.
And it's real forest. And you're all welcome to come up to Inwood. Inwood Hill Park is an old growth forest.
Inwood, where is it?
Inwood Hill. It's at the very top of the island. It's natural forest. And we've, with lightning strikes and whatnot, we've counted trees well over 200 rings.
Beautiful.
So it's right here in my
yard.
Thank
Last
you.
Last stop on the atrium.
Come
on.
Last stop.
Thank you.
That's very good to know. Access to nature is
every day. I want to come
very good. So I'm talking about like a forest that sort of has maybe that's recently grown in. The oak trees are 15, 20 feet apart, you know, 50, 60 feet tall. Ever been to a forest like that?
Yeah.
The trees are close
yeah.
together, they're tall and they're skinny, and they got a little bit of branches up on top. But for each plant, I mean, branches, as opposed to a big old oak tree, which is just broad and, you know, just, it's a round shape. It's a you know, stocky. From my perspective, you want your crops to take that broad, stocky shape, which means that you need to give them enough space when you plant them that 3 months from now, they'll be able to be that big. So if you're talking about cabbage and broccoli, you know, a good 2 feet apart, ideally 3, right? Tomatoes, 4-5 feet apart. You know, your Swiss chards, you know, at least 18 inches. You know, really peppers, eggplant. You know, eggplant will happily grow 7 feet tall, no problem. You know, a pepper plant will easily be 6 to 8 feet tall. And broad, as many feet as possible. If given the space and proper environmental conditions, and when that happens, when it gets any bigger and stronger, the system is actually much more powerful. So you actually have an increase of yield with a decrease in plant population. This is being done across the planet in numerous countries with amazing grassroots manners. And almost no Americans have ever heard of this. It's called SRI, System of Rice and Desertification. Started in Madagascar 20 years ago. There's tens of millions of subsistence farmers in dozens of countries, from Morocco to Polynesia, who are, you know, growing rice, planting, you know, dramatically fewer plants per square meter, not flooding it, and doubling, quadrupling, upping the yield, dramatically increasing yields by decreasing the plant population and taking good care of those plants, giving them the environmental conditions where they can thrive. Look it up, SRI. This is a story that needs to be told. Anybody looking for a good story? System of Rice Intensification. It's called SCI sometimes, System of Crop Intensification. There's a guy at Cornell who's an ex officio, I'm not sure what he is. He's a Norman Upon, who's helping to spread the word, but you've got a center there. This is an amazing story. And anybody who tells you that, you know, we have resource issues and things like that, you know, we can solve these problems. And this is being done, you know, without top-down, you know, publicity, money, funding, corporate influence. This is you know, grassroots, word of mouth, real empowerment going on. But yes, the basic principle here is you give your plants enough space for them to manifest their full potential. Yes.
So I'm thinking about the relative importance of crop-facing horizontally versus the depth. So if you give your plants like a lot of space
mm-hmm.
out
yes.
between them and their plants, but then you only have like about 18 inches of depth, then are you just screwing the plants because you go out and can't go down?
12-18 inches of real good live soil should be enough to grow a pretty big plant. You know, you have air and moisture and light throughout that entire 18-inch soil profile, you can grow quite a big healthy plant. The thing is, you don't have much space. So this is where you get the argument for interplanting, right? People about interplanting, tomatoes like, you know, basil and all that stuff. The more plants you have growing together, the better. The more families of plants growing together, the better. Just plant them and time them so that, you know, if you put your radishes in at the same time you put your tomatoes in and your lettuce all together, the radishes and the lettuce will be gone by the time the tomatoes can figure out the shape. Make sense? Flowers, herbs, look it up. You know, if you've got somebody who's intuitive, have them talk to your plants and ask them who wants to plant with who. And get serious.
Is the SRA, is that the one-star revolution? Is that the same?
No. That's Masanobu Fukuoka.
Right. Because what it is...
We're all doing the same thing.
Right, but it's...
Right, there's lots of us all over the place. We'll pop it up.
Out of the water.
Thank you.
It's not hard to succeed. I mean, the fact is you make more money, you know, on less land with less work, working in harmony with life. It's from a farmer's perspective, we're not farming Monsanto, we're educating farmers. And we're providing them with tools to, you know, work in harmony with life and make a better living. Right? We're not talking policy, we're not talking, you know, politics. It's nothing to do with that. It's simply about economic viability and quality of life. And if we can, and this is from our perspective, the strategy of how we do this. And it's not that hard. We all have to start doing it, getting the results, showing our neighbors what's possible, and then spreading the word. Right, walk your talk. Actions speak louder than words.
I'm just thinking of this, have anyone heard of this Munchausen syndrome? Mm-hmm. So this is where somebody has a mental illness where they actually harm somebody and then they rush in and rescue them and they get kind of first. And I feel like this is kind of what we're dealing with, is these companies that are going in there to destroy the environment and say, now we have the answer, you have to come to us and be dependent on us, we're going to rescue you all. And I think we really have to just totally bypass them.
As long as we're ignorant.
Yes.
And we don't know anything better.
And
that's our only source of information.
Part of what they're doing is trying to keep it.
Which is why we need to build a decentralized, you know, nonprofit, educational, grassroots movement, food movement, social movement. Right? From my perspective, this is good. This is strategy. This is movement strategy. And this is it, soil. The movement strategy is start at the bottom of the food chain and work your way up. And revitalize the land, you know, step by step, piece by piece, and show me what can happen, and provide the, you know, educate about the incentives. Your children are going to, A, want to eat their vegetables, and B, not have these degenerative diseases if they eat high-quality food. You will be able to, you know, live on the land and you know, live a farming lifestyle without having to work 12 hours a day if you work intelligently with the land, right? And we can do this. See, we can solve these problems. So, anyway, I don't need to
directly into the soil, and you know, and then they're all kind of close together.
Yeah.
By the time they have sprouted and you're thinning, have they already experienced plant conditions that are limiting their potential?
To some extent. The question is, I mean, from my perspective, what I do with salad mix is I generally grow much too close together because I'm trying to get pounds per square foot. And so I want my plants to be close together. I just feed them a lot. So even though they're tight together, they're still growing vigorously. And so I'm not talking about growing a big, you know, beautiful tomato plant. I'm talking about growing 2-inch, 3-inch leaf that I'm going to clear cut with my scissors. So I just broadcast my seed. I don't burden rows. I broadcast it, rake it in, water it down with some goodies. We'll get to that right now. Monitor conductivity, make sure there's enough energy in the soil. And if you can monitor conductivity, you can make sure that the plants are getting fed. Even though they're close, they still have enough energy to keep growing and be vigorous. But you're not trying to grow them to be big, beautiful heads. In that case, I would say that, I said this before, but I'll say it again. When you're starting your seeds, if you do start seeds, start way more seeds than you want to grow, and monitor closely the germination process in the early plant life, the first week or two of life, and you can see which plants are the biggest, the most vigorous, and take those out and give them special care and give away the rest. You want to, you know, we talk about seed quality being a serious issue. It is a really serious issue. Seed quality is a really serious issue. And everything else you do, if you don't have good seed, you're starting, you know, way behind. So the best thing to do is to germinate your seed and see which plants are most vigorous and sort, you know, select out those and give them lots of space and lots of attention and lots of food and plant those with the soil. Those are the plants that live the best through the year. So that's spacing, root-top balance. I talk about root-top balance. You also have the root be larger than the top. And you can do that by, you know, having large pots in your seedlings and keeping your soil moist across the entire profile. If you just have one line of wet surrounded by dry, at some point the root systems are not able to reach out further, and the top overextends, and you have that same, you know, okay, and then the final point here on the slide on this page is intention. And just recount an anecdote. Last summer, I was on a friend's farm in a couple towns away from us, and she had about an acre of vegetables, and she was doing a good job, you know, managing. Most people would be very happy with the garden; it was theirs. I was walking through, and we were just, you know, checking things out, and We came across the onion patch, and it was exceptional. I mean, just every single onion was like softball size, just big, beautiful, solid, hard onions. My God. And I was like, what did you do here? Because everything else looks nice, but these are really exceptional. What did you do? And she's like, well, what are you doing in here? We gave them all the, you know, minerals and foliage. And I'm like, no, you did something different in these onions. What was it? like, think about it for a second. And it took her a minute or two, and then she realized it was, you know, late February, early March, and the crew was all had spring fever, you know, looking excited to play in the dirt again. And they stopped for a moment before planting the seeds and held hands and just had a silent prayer for the seeds, around the seeds. And I was like, oh, that'll do it. That's obviously the answer. And maybe that's not the absolute answer for everybody here, but I would like to express myself clearly. I think that your state of being, your state of mind, your energy, you know, when you're with your plants is a profound effect. Just because you don't understand frequencies and vibration and how living systems communicate with each other through vibration doesn't mean it doesn't happen. We all have had experiences of walking into a room and knowing someone who just had a fight, right? I mean, you can feel it in the room. Everybody?
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? Right. You weren't there. Your five physical senses were not used to make that, you know, to figure that out. But you know very well what just happened there. Now, which sense is that?
Six.
Call it whatever you want to call it. There's different languages. People call it their heart, divas, you know, whatever you want to call it. I don't care what you call it. But that's the sense. That state of that vibe you want to hold when you're with your plants. And the more you can, the better you can, the better they're going to grow, I suggest. So intention is my safe word for that. Okay, page two.
Actually,
just 10 minutes.
Just 10 minutes. So 11:15, you've got to be back.
Don't worry. The bathroom's right in that door. It's cool. 10 minutes. Probably sometime between 12:30 and 1. Okay? You're welcome. All right. All ready to go? Get your zip drive cleared out and your zip on the download. Okay, have a page two. Cover crop and crop process. How do you actually go about the process of planting your plants? This is, I'm not religious about much, I'm not dogmatic about much, but I'm very clear about this process. I think it's really important how you put your seeds or your plants into the soil, the actual specifics of it. So I'm going to go over some detail of it. So we're starting here at the cover crop process, page 2. Address removal deficiencies based on self-test results and recommendations. We already went over that. Hopefully you've done it. If you haven't, you still have time, but be quick about it. Always apply minerals with a carbon source like humates or compost or biochar. That is specific to your trace elements. All of them are good to do. Ideally put them in the compost pile anyways, but especially trace elements, make sure you buffer them with a carbon source before you put them in. Apply your fertilizer. Now, we talked about this 1,000 pounds per acre basic fertilizer, so I'm just going to give you a rough recipe. Okay, so we got rock phosphate, got lime, gypsum, sulfamag, K-mag, humates, alfalfa meal, I would do some kelp meal, and some Redmond salt. Redmond salt, C90.
Isn't that from Utah?
Somewhere out there. Yeah, I think that's what I was. C90 you can use too. Redmond salt's got a finer particle size generally, so it spreads more evenly. The C90 generally comes in chunks, and so it's a little bit harder to spread.
What is K-mag?
K-mag or sulfomag, it's called. There's two. It's a rock mineral. It's kind of it's like a salt. It's mined out of Utah or something. Let's call it. Okay, let's do. So if you're going to do a compost. Some people like to put compost down. Certainly feel free to add compost to this or to add this to your compost. Depending on how much compost you're using, you can probably take the alfalfa meal out. So alfalfa meal slash compost. So if we call this 200 pounds per acre, call this 50, 50, 100, 150, 150, 100. What do we have in here? 2, 5, 3. Okay, we need 200 pounds of humates. Is that clear?
What's the last one? The
Redmond salt. Some kind of a sea salt type material. 50 pounds per acre. Kelp meal, 50 pounds per acre. Alfalfa meal or compost, 200 pounds per acre. Humates, 200. Alpha mag, 100. Gypsum, 150. Lime, 150. Rock and phosphate, 100. And all these guys can go up or down. I mean, humates is kind of high, humates is low right now. So 200 pounds per acre. Would be a ballpark. Yes.
Is this still in the process of trying to build good kelp, or is this with an established garden that's been established?
This is something that, you know, until you feel confident that your soil is up and running and in great shape, you should be doing it on a manual basis. Good proactive management. This is right before we plant. So we are basically right now before. So I'm walking you through this slides here, top of page 2, in a stepwise fashion. So how to go from your cover crops? I mean, people probably, most people have, do not have cover crops planted. Is that correct? Rye, over, you know, winter rye. Anybody have rye going right now? A couple people. People have mulch on their field, on their garden beds. Only a couple. Vetch growing. Field peas, maybe
it didn't seed well.
Anyway, so where we are now, right? Between, you know, in the next 2 or 3 weeks, you're probably going to start wanting to get out there in the soil and prepare some beds and put some seeds in the ground. Yes? Most people? Okay, so we're right there now. Where we are now, I would put this, we're assuming you've already done these two things, the first two, taking your soil test, address your mineral deficiencies. If you haven't done that, do that now. And then, before you prepare your bed, put this basic fertilizer down. Okay? And then integrate into the soil an inch or two as you're preparing your bed. However you prepare your bed, with a rake or with a rototiller, whatever you do, ideally you want to minimize the depth of the tillage, but you're going to try to, you know, put this down and then integrate into the soil as you're part of your bed prep.
Process. Do you do this on top of whatever your soil test is telling you to have?
Yes. This is our one of my plants taking out of the soil this year. I want my tank to be full, and I want to keep it full by giving the plants in the spring everything they need to function through the year, right? In a proactive fashion. Yes.
You mentioned buffering the carbon source. Why?
Trace elements.
Be the question.
In direct contact with soil life, they will kill them. And you want to buffer that. And you want to keep them from leaching. The trace elements are salt, so if you have a heavy rain and you don't have a carbon buffer, they will go down out through your soil and you won't get to use them.
And the carbon buffer is what?
Either humates or, I think, molasses, biochar, compost, something, some organic type material. Mixed up with the trace elements specifically. And the last thing is, because if you buffer them with the carbon, they'll be more digestible to the soil. More edible. Yes.
What sort of excess sunset compost?
Don't put it in.
Adjust
accordingly. This is a ballpark, this is a range, a general suggestion. If you've got 85% calcium already, don't put it in limestone. Pounds per acre. These are all pounds per acre.
Just two questions. One, would the rock phosphate, lime, and gypsum be able to actually be utilized by the plants that year if they applied just before planting? Because wouldn't they need some more? Wouldn't they need to be applied in the fall to circulate nutrients?
So what we're trying to do here is we're mixing all these things together for starters.
Sure.
So if you've got a good compost, say, that's going to be mixing in with this, the humates, This is a little bit of salt. Basically, what you're going to be doing is you're going to be creating an area across the soil where everything is in fresh supply and mixed with life and buffered, so that it's, you know, you just have a nice, easy platter out there. I don't know how to say it. I mean, I hear what you're saying. And if the soil is already functioning well, mm-hmm. and you think it can, you know, function well by itself, you should not need to add this.
Okay.
In most cases, people find the benefits in doing something like this.
I was just only curious just about the specific minerals that were tied up in rock, which you said before. Need a season to break down so the plants can.
This is a proactive.
I see.
We're feeding the plants through the year. What's going to happen is we're going to be mixing all this stuff in together. So you got life, you got carbon, you got energy, you got minerals, and you're putting them into the soil. And in a minute, we're going to show you. We're basically going to make a little compost pile in there in that soil. So as the season progresses and as the plant roots get bigger, that they're being digested and they're being made available to feed the plants. To grow big and strong. But first step is to get it down, and I would broadcast it across your entire growing area.
And if we're not going to do any tillage, if we're doing like a no-till kind of a situation, just broadcast on the top and maybe just work it in.
Scratch it in with a rake.
Okay, gotcha. And it'll
scratch it in with a rake.
Sounds good.
Evenly broadcast it, which is not a lot of material.
Yeah.
It's not a lot of material.
No, yeah, definitely.
Azomite, okay, instead of Redmond's, because I have a source of azomite.
I would definitely add azomite to this ingredient list, but do not substitute it for Redmond salts.
Oh, okay.
Redmond salt provides conductivity.
Okay.
It provides charge to the system, electrical charge to the system.
Okay.
And that's a very important component, especially in spring soil.
And granular or micronized azomite?
Either one's fine.
Okay.
In general, the smaller the particle size, the better.
Okay.
But either one's fine. Because the granulated is just micronized, granulated into little pellets.
Okay.
Yes.
And this, what you gave us, is that you make some compost with 200 watt sufficient mixing of the carbon with this these minerals. You have that more.
That's gratuitous.
Yes.
Doesn't have to be that much.
Yes. What work do you use worm beds for the compost?
Yeah. Worm casting?
Worm beds to make compost instead of the traditional compost.
If we were to run a lot of these phosphates and limes and gypsums through the compost in order to get them more bioavailable, what is that going to do to the worms? Anything necessarily, because you're kind of overdosing them in the pile in order to get this recipe for a broad acre.
I play with it. Yeah. I experiment. Yeah. I do a quarter dose, half dose, a four times dose, and put worms in all different bins and see what causes them to thrive and what causes them to suffer.
Yeah.
And if some level of this is really beneficial, and they're going to, be greater vigor about that, but you don't know what it is.
Yeah.
So you try it out. And most importantly, what the other stuff you're eating.
Yeah.
You can't make any recommendations until you know what the base of the whole
thing is. Yeah, exactly.
I just wonder if you would speak to the whole nitrogen thing. I know. it's a legacy issue with me, but
legacy issue.
I'm just having a hard time wrapping my head around
it. Okay. You walk through the forest. Has anybody applied any nitrogen fertilizer in that forest in the past 200 years?
We have a lot of worms.
Has anybody applied nitrogen fertilizer in the past 200 years?
I don't think so.
Probably not. How many of those plants are legumes?
I don't think any.
So where are they getting the nitrogen from?
It's magic. I don't know. I can't,
it's really simple. In nature, all plants have the capacity to source out of the air all the nitrogen they could ever possibly need. Because they have symbiotic relationships set up with bacteria and fungi who have the functional capacity to take nitrogen out of the air and basically convert it into a form that's plant available. And the plants feed, they exude sugars out their leaves, not just out their roots, and set up these communities as part of the basic process of life. That's just how it happens. And if you don't have those species present, and you don't have the key trace elements that are used at the core of the enzymes that are the actual tool by which this occurs, then it's not going to happen. You need the minerals and the minerals for the core of the enzymes and the species of life present. And if those two things are there, if they're set up and functioning, you do not need to add nitrogen to your crop. You do not need to feed your plants nitrogen. It's entirely unnecessary because life is already feeding it to them. It will in a functioning system.
I'm going to try this.
That's all you can do.
I still just am like,
and you know what? You know, if you want to be a slowly wean yourself, you know, that's totally fine with me.
Do a little chicken comp when you're on it.
What's, you know, yeah. I mean, it's okay.
All right.
It's unnecessary.
Okay.
It's unnecessary. It should be unnecessary.
Would it be harmful?
If you put too much, you know.
Would it cause an imbalance?
What it'll do is it'll. I mean, too much can certainly be harmful because the plants will get big and watery and weak cell walls and things. The problem with putting stuff like that in is that the plant doesn't have to set up the symbiotic relationship if it's already being fed to it.
Kind of like antibiotics, it's like it affects the immune system in a way.
Antibiotics are a little bit different, but
yeah, a little. But
yeah,
but it's like saying you don't have to do the work.
Yeah.
You're doing the work.
And then when the plant runs out of nitrogen that you fed it 3 weeks later, it doesn't have that community set up. It doesn't have that functional biological community established. And then you have a crash. And then you have that nitrogen because you basically got to add it, right? You got to crack at it.
Dependency.
Yeah.
So you're actually doing this. You don't, on your own farm, it's not like someone says, oh, yeah, but that's poppycock. But you don't add nitrogen.
Why should I add nitrogen? It's unnecessary. For me, it's an economic, it's not really an economic issue. I can certainly afford it because I'm making lots of good money in my greens. But as a farmer, on principle, I shouldn't have to do this. And if people have a problem with nitrogen fertilizer, anybody? You know, like Gulf of Mexico, dead zones? I mean, logistics, right? Where did this idea come from, nitrogen fertilizer? World War II, the armaments industry was manufacturing explosives, and they had figured out this Haber-Bosch process to synthesize nitrogen out of the atmosphere and, make explosives. And at the end of the war, they had all this unused capacity. They needed a market. This is the history of nitrogen fertilizer. It's dark like a lot of other history is. It's a simple fact, though, that, go back long enough, and this was not being done. And they had more and more and more every year, because the system is more and more dead, and they have to add more to get the same effect. It's a dependency issue.
When you first started, you said that 1 pound molasses, 1 pound peanuts, and 1 pound seawater. Is this list different? Which ones go first? We should start the season with 1 pound molasses tonight.
I was giving you a very specific suggestion about how to enliven the soil right now if you wanted to plant seedlings into it. It was a specific question about what do I do if my seedlings come early. And I said, you've got a couple of key issues. The soil is too cold, there's no light. And if you want to warm it up and enliven it, put some of this stuff in and put a piece of black plastic, clear plastic over it, and that will, hasten the spring functionally in that area by, weeks in days. So that was a very specific, response to a specific question. Not a general. It wouldn't be a bad general practice, and it would be, a good thing to do in the fall when you put everything in the bed, give it a little bit of food for the soil life in the winter.
Diatomaceous earth, benefits or harm?
I don't use it much. I don't have a use for it. Certainly they say it's good for slugs. It's a calcium source. If you wanted to put it in your compost pile.
Ruin kill small organisms, beneficial insects?
I think it's the soft people, that get ripped apart by it. It's not a killer. It's just abrasive. So it's like walking on razor blades for the slugs. It's just, at some point they're not in good shape. So that's how you kill them. So just looking into that. Other than that, I don't know. I don't use it personally. Do you have a question about that?
Just about just the differentiation between, I'm just trying to figure it out for myself because I'm learning a number of things now. Using nitrogen, synthetic nitrogen fertilizers, which are water soluble, which you referred to, after World War II started making, et cetera, and that's been the primary thing that's, killed, created algal blooms and
Phosphorus, too.
Phosphorus, exactly, in the Gulf, et cetera.
Right.
It's my impression that if you use manures, you know, naturally occurring animal manures, which are a very, very ancient practice, it seems.
In moderation.
In moderation, right. Those are the things that are causing these terrible blooms.
Depending on if you go to Lake Champlain in Vermont, you know, has dairy manure that's spread in the fields that washes in, you know, is the cause of blooms.
This is
you know, anything in excess, anything out of balance. From my perspective, you know, animal manure is a great material to use. Yeah. I would use it in the compost pile.
Okay.
I get my wood chips, my sawdust, my animal manure, maybe a little bit of, you know, straw or hay bedding, and that is an awesome base to make amazing compost out of.
Right.
With that, I can put in my, you know, minerals, I can put in my inoculants, I can put in my, you know, biodynamic preparations, and make a great bioinoculant.
Right.
But the issue is, you know, adding nitrogen in principle is unnecessary.
Okay, understood.
Certainly can be used, and organic farmers who don't have a functioning biological system need a source.
Sure.
But if they could solve the issue of a non-functioning biological system, they don't necessarily need a source.
But the manure itself, it also contains phosphorus and microbes.
Yes.
So it does have other.
If anybody's got an old dead lawn or field that they want to revitalize, like you're buying an old hay field, right? Here you are, this is all exciting, you save up money, 3 years from now, you've got your piece of land, it's in rough shape. The best way to revitalize land is run chickens over it.
Right.
You take a chicken tractor and you just run it through your field, that's magic. I mean, the life in the manure and the nutrition in the manure revitalizes the life in the soil.
Okay.
It's powerful.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There's definitely a role for animals in an integrated system.
Yeah, okay. I just want to make sure parse that out and look in our conversation.
Cool.
So I'm going to pick up on Jamie's diatomaceous. We use it a lot in the city for chickens just as a mite situation. We give them diatomaceous that. And I wanted to pick up from what you just said, you have chickens on the property as well. And you use that.
I don't use it.
I don't mean the diet, but you use the chickens on the property.
Yes.
To do the tractoring and stuff.
I've got a restaurant in Harvard Square that pays me $7 a pound for chicken. $50 chickens.
So here in the city, we're using it.
Scam, anyone? $50 chicken. So we'd like six this week. There's $300.
What?
This is the best tasting chicken I've ever had in my entire life. I'm like, well, you know, that's not bad, but it's not that good. You know, you're a crazy chef in a crazy restaurant.
So we were using it to give them baths.
Okay.
Because we have more mite problems.
Yes.
Because of the closer quarters in the city, and they don't get don't get out as much.
Fair enough. Yeah, if they're running outside and they're, you know, decently happy, they're probably not going to be an issue. But certainly, you know, that kind of stuff is a really good, you know, it's non-toxic, you know, way of dealing with things. Much better than kind of chemicals, certainly.
I had a flea problem on my, you know, house out in the suburbs, so it's supposed to help with the fleas, but maybe not.
Fleas? Really? I don't know. I thought it worked more on bedbugs.
City problems, maybe. Good for city people.
I want to go on another rant about so close. Poorly doable. So easy. Everyone chooses their. Make your bed that you sleep in.
What, you're saying that we should all be up farming outside the city? Is that what you're saying?
As far as I'm concerned, you know, 5 acres is enough to have a complete life.
You could grow some great stuff on the roofs here. I mean, if you get anyone that's willing to get above. Well, it's also fresher than what's coming in from the farmers.
And be barefoot and have your kids running around. I mean, with trees and nature and community, I mean.
So can we wait for this afternoon just so we can take
a walk? What's the objective here? What's my real objective?
That is the problem.
Anyway,
you're selling land, are you?
Along with chickens.
I was looking at land in upstate New York last summer. It was $1,500 an acre. You could buy a 400-acre farm with three barns and two houses for $600,000, which apparently is what you guys call, you know, a house.
Right.
A studio?
A condominium.
A room. It's a room.
I think people are afraid that they're going to frack up there and they're scared.
I mean, we're above the Marcellus Shale.
Oh, okay.
North of the Marcellus Shale. If the farther south you go, the more the land is worth because of the fracking. You go up north where it's cheap. You're a couple hundred miles out of here. You buy a 400-acre farm. You and, you know, 20 other couples, and you each get 20 acres, and it costs you $30,000 each. And you've got a community, and you can do all this stuff in a collaborative fashion. $50,000 an acre. All right. You've applied your fertilizer. You've integrated your cover crop. You've worked your soil. You've prepared your bed. Okay? Ground is ready to plant. You're ready to plant. What do you do? First thing, before you plant, generally, is you make a row for your seeds, or you make a hole for your transplants. Yes? Everybody comfortable with that? Those who are paying attention?
Yes.
We've gotten to a much more dry topic here. After you do that, from my perspective, you need to understand this thing called conductivity, which is functionally, and the metaphor that I like to use is calories per day available. Right? You know about calories per day, they're like labeling food now, 200 calories and things like that, right? So if you're a 5-year-old, what do you need? 500 calories, 600 calories a day? If you're a normal adult, you need 2,000 calories. If you're pregnant, you need 4,000 calories, right? I mean, there's like a general spectrum of how much food you need to go through the day. And different stages in life, you need different amounts. So your soil conductivity meter will tell you how many ions are present in the soil. Ions, not just simple ions, complex ions, right? Sugars, carbohydrates, amino acids, those are all ions. So you stick this conductivity in the soil, press the button, it actually has a temperature button, so you can check the soil temperature also. You don't need to use this meter, but it's probably a good investment. Turn it on, stick it in the soil, you get a reading. How much energy in the form of nutrition, food, is available to my plants right now in the soil? Now what happens generally, if you just were to go put your conductivity meter in the soil, you'll see it'll be about like 30 or 50. I would say you need at least 150 when you put the plants in the ground, seeds or seedlings, and depending on your organic matter level in the soil, you may need to go up to 400 or 600 or 800 when the plant is in peak productivity mode for it to be able to get enough food to go through its basic biological processes. That pregnant mother needs 4,000 calories. Your soil conductivity needs to be at 400 when your tomatoes are filling their fruit. That work?
How much in the beginning?
I'm giving you the concept first. So I'll give you the details.
Oh, okay.
Is everybody comfortable with this conceptually? Mm-hmm. Is this like seeming like, you know, I can grok this?
How much does that cost?
$85.
Do you have a question? The unit, it measures it in units of per, it's 100 per 400 of
what?
Ions per.
There are basically, depending on the meter you get, it will come in millisiemens or microsiemens.
Okay.
And 1 meter will say 400, and 1 meter will say 0.4.
Excuse me.
Now, who can tell me which one's which? Because I can't.
The microsiemens are the 400. And the mill is
micro.
And then the mill is the mill.
SIEMENS, like the company?
Yes.
There's a scientific notation for those words. Doesn't really matter. All that matters is that this is a conversion. So whichever meter you have, I'm gonna give you numbers. They're your targets, and you've got to figure out what your meter is, if it's this one or that one, and adjust and attend accordingly. So basically, this meter right here reads out in hundreds. It's calibrated to microsiemens. The soil test, if anybody's got a copy of their soil test, is actually in millisiemens. On the bottom of your soil test, on the last slide, on your loaded soil test, it says EC. You know this. And it'll say 0.01 or 0.05 or 0.1 or 0.2.
EC, exchange, 0.9, exchange,
electrical conductivity.
Oh.
the exchange capacity also is either cation exchange capacity or total exchange capacity. In this case, it says TEC at the top.
TEC.
Do you have a local for this?
I
don't know. It's probably not on your form. Most labs don't even bother checking. 114, which is 104. So in the middle of the winter, that's good. Yes. It doesn't really matter because nothing's growing in the middle of the winter. What matters is when you put your seeds in the ground, or when you put your seedling in the ground, here's my hole where I'm going to be putting my tomato, right? The bent tomato. I want the EC right here to be at least 150 or 0.15 when I put that seedling in the ground. Period. Full stop, end of story. And if you manage conductivity in a proactive fashion, which you can do, you can make sure that your plants always have enough food to get through the season. And then they don't end up crashing. Usually the soil dries out, conductivity drops, the plants starve to death, they get diseased, and you know, they crash. You can monitor conductivity very proactively, 1 to 2 weeks ahead of time. Before you see any discoloration or disease, you'll see that the conductivity go down. You feed the plants, which we'll get to in a second. But for starters, we're just planting the plants. And you need to get the conductivity up high enough when you put those plants up in the ground for them to grow. Yes?
It's going to go up naturally anyway, right? The temperature going up?
With increased biological activity and increased levels of compounds being released into the soil, it will go up naturally. And it should be, the plant, if it's established as a good root system, will be able to facilitate that increase in conductivity by feeding the soil life when it needs more nutrition, when it's feeding and filling its fruit. So in a healthily functioning system, you'll see this kind of a curve. It'll start here and just go like that, right? And what you want to do is you want to come in every week and check your soil conductivity, and you want to monitor it. And so this is what you want to see, and this is what you probably will see. And so when this happens right there, you can see it's happening and do something about it. Because right here is where the plant dies.
When you check your soil, so do you go out and have certain areas that you check, or how do you check your soil?
I propose a new religious ceremony. People used to go to church every Sunday. Remember that in the old days?
Yes.
Some people will probably go to church tomorrow. Okay. May go to church tomorrow. But in general, we don't have that sort of regular, you know, ceremonial process. I would suggest a weekly hour in the garden where you go out and actually attend to the nuances and details. And this would be this is a great little metric to use to train your mind to tune into the more subtle, you know, nuances that you otherwise perhaps wouldn't notice. It's very interesting, very powerful. I would, you know, Tuesday morning at 7, doesn't have to be on a weekend, doesn't have to be, you know, whatever. Get out there with your conductivity meter, your refractometer, and your eyes, and your senses, and attend to what's actually going on, and monitor these things. And you can really find out a real lot, and you can get proactive about things. The objective is to get proactive so that you're not having to react when the plants are sick. You can keep them healthy.
So are you testing like every couple of feet, or are you just observing and sort of seeing what you think you need to test?
Until you figure out what you're doing, you're experimenting. So if you take this conductivity meter and you stick it in the ground right where your drip tape is, and you just put a nutrient branch down and it's 250, you're like, oh, great, soil's great. You move it over a foot where the soil's been dry for a week and a half, and you get zero reading. That tells you there's enough energy here, but not there. And so you can attend to your management to address that systemically. Mm-hmm. This is how you can see how well things are functioning. As you can see, okay, in this area here, roughly, things seem to be okay, but over here it's not working. So what can I do differently to build the vitality of the soil in this area? And figure out how to, you know, work with it to make it a living matrix all the way across. If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yes?
So the conductivity is measuring the ions in the moisture in the soil.
Yes.
So if you're getting low readings, that means you need to have more ions or moisture. If you don't have any water, you're not going to contribute. So
yes.
Is it a way of measuring the effectiveness of your feeding of the plants?
It's basically measuring functionally how well the plants are doing. You should not have to feed your plants, right? You should have a healthily functioning system where the plants are feeding themselves. Mm-hmm. That's your objective. And you're going to take steps between now and there to keep the plants healthy and build the vitality system so you can head in that direction. But that's a systemic objective. But functionally, it's the ions in solution, simple and complex, ideally more complex and simple, that is going to give you the reading. And certainly, if you find there's no reading over here, that is a good sign. You let that soil dry out, and you damn well better do something about it, right? If the soil is too dry to get a reading, you have already screwed up. And that's something you should not have let happen. Now do something about it. If you weren't out there with a conductivity meter, you might not have noticed that. Yes? Mm-hmm. Make sense? It's a tool to help, you know, develop your perception and to give you some sort of a logical metric to guide yourself by. Yes?
So it's usually that you just need to water?
No. If you don't have water, everything else is irrelevant.
Right, right. But
so first thing to do is to water the soil, right. And then you can start to see what's going on.
Okay. So but now if you put it in and it's still, like, it's moist, mm-hmm. but it's still not the reading you want it to be.
Yes.
How do you know which of the many things to do? I mean, what...
This is where the art comes in. Yes. And we're going to spend the rest of the day basically talking about that. Visual analysis, you know, specifics of what these plants generally want, et cetera.
You could do a soil test during the season too, though, couldn't you? Yeah, okay.
There's lots of things we can do. That's what the rest of the day is about, is how to monitor this and manage it in a proactive, you know, sensitive, holistic fashion. That's what the objective is. You know, set the foundation in place where the plant has access to what it needs, and then, you know, help it along its way. Anybody raise kids here? Anybody? It's a continuous management process, right? You read the environment, you see what's going on, is this setting them off? Is this unacceptable? You know, and create an environment where things are going to flourish and maintain their center. Understand what the nuances are. And it's being attentive and being sensitive. So make your row or your hole, test your conductivity, and if it's not at this level of 150, then you want to do something about it. From my perspective, in general, I put something in that hole anyways, in a proactive fashion. The same way I put a fertilizer down in a proactive fashion, I put some goodies in the hole in a proactive fashion. I make the hole, I water the goodies in, and then I transplant. I do not make a hole and transplant and then water on top of the soil. If anyone's ever done that, you do the watering on top of the soil for yourself, not for the plant. Because when you get done, the soil looks wet and you feel good about yourself. The roots are still dry. Ever scratch the soil surface after you've watered to see how deep that water actually went down? About a quarter inch, maybe a half. When you're transplanting, especially, you want to water the hole first until you've got a nice, moist, you know, wet soil. Plop with goodies, plop that seedling in there. My test for if I did a good job transplanting or not is to come along the next day, 24 hours later, and dig up a representative seedling gently and see if I have roots coming out of that root ball in all directions. If I do not see roots coming out in all directions, 24 hours after transplanting, I did not do a good job, and I should not expect this plant to thrive. Just because I put it in the ground doesn't mean it's got everything it needs. I need to see evidence that it's vigorous and vital for me to feel comfortable that, you know, it's got what it needs. Yes?
That root ball dissipates 3 weeks later, it's no longer a root ball, it's going to extend it all the way out.
It should be extended out, I mean, literally 24 hours later, I want to see roots, new roots coming out in all directions. And then if I do see that, I expect that's going to be continuing as long as I manage the soil itself effects. Okay? Okay, so that's the basic, there's the concepts of the technical details of how you do it. Okay, so what do you put in the hole? For me, I've got my basic ingredients here. Fungal and bacterial inoculants, I want to get into that hole all the spores, all the different people that I want to be symbiotically working with my plants. In my you know, situation, I just buy those spores. But I would like to give you a quick recipe for how you can harvest them and make them yourself. So I'm not sure how many microclimates you have in Central Park or whatever this old forest is here, but my objective generally is to hit as many different microclimates as possible. So I'd like to hit a stream, a marsh, a forest, you know, a field, a meadow, as many different microclimates as I can, and I'm paying close attention to which plants are looking particularly vital and, you know, striking at this moment. I generally do this with a 5-gallon bucket, which may or may not be, you know, gauche, but generally take a bucket, go for a walk, hit a bunch of different microclimates, and harvest leaves and plant parts. So I'll take lichen off of a tree, I'll take moss off of a stone, I'll take, you know, ferns if they're looking, you know, really glossy, I'll take goldenrod if it's looking pretty, pigweed, doesn't really matter what the plant is. I want to get a bunch of different plants that are all looking, you know, really shiny. You want to get that shiny leaf, that bright color, not the worn out, you know, brown, faded color plants, the ones that are in peak vigor. Harvest them, put them in your bucket, when you get back home, you know, cover the plants, fill the bucket up with lukewarm water, and let it sit overnight. And you've just harvested a broad swath of bacteria and fungi from your environment. As after they sit in the water, they'll wash off the leaf, and they'll be in that water. You can take that water and water it into your bowl, and you've got the bacteria from the nut. Like in moss, sure, you can get some leaves if you want. Go for it. Yeah. It's a nice, you know, duff from the forest floor. Yeah.
I didn't follow your logic on that. You're taking the top of the plants and trying to get the parts of the roots that are going to make, that give life to that plant. Why not just take the roots of those plants that are shiny and green?
And you can take all different parts. You're looking for the plants you're going to be harvesting from are the ones that are looking shiny right now. Soil immediately surrounding the roots.
Yeah.
Sure. A lot of these species live both above and below ground. It may be easier to harvest these. Whatever. It's a general point, and that is that you can harvest a lot of these inoculants from your local environment if you so choose. That's it. All interesting to you. Look out IMOs, indigenous microorganisms. There's a whole bunch of information online for recipes within the next few years. Step two is enzymes. I, again, you know, purchase enzymes, but my understanding is you can make them out of that same wheat tea that you've got. Put a lid on the bucket and let it sit for 6 weeks and wait for the pH to drop below 4.5. Once the pH is dropped in that bucket and there's water, it usually takes 6 to 8 weeks at, you know, lukewarm temperatures. You will have functional enzymes in that water. Literally be enzymes. So you can pour them off, you know, into a bottle, stick them in the basement, you know, pantry, wherever you've got space, and let them sit, and you can use them next year, or, you know, over time as you wish. But you want to get both inoculants and enzymes into that bowl, along with a couple minerals. You want to have the life component and the mineral component in this hole. That's what helps those roots, you know, grow rapidly overnight.
Okay, wait 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Or 2 weeks. That what are you putting in before the water?
Same thing.
Oh.
You take your wheat tea, you get two buckets. One of them you pour off overnight. The next morning for your transplanting. The next one you put a lid on.
So you wait until the pH drops to what?
4.5, okay, below.
And do you keep the leaves inside?
Yes, absolutely. Leave it all there. Just pull it up. Just pull it off and stick it in the corner, and it'll ferment. It should be pretty rank. It'll definitely have a strong moisture. You know, 70 degrees. If you can keep it at a consistent warm temperature, that'll, you know, speed the process. So if it's outside and it's 110 degrees in the sun, in the bucket, the water's going to cook, and the fermentation process probably is short-circuiting. So then I have my last two ingredients, or three here. Sea minerals, again, the sea minerals, seawater. I use a concentrated seawater that has the sodium and chlorine taken out, called an Ormus. We talked about this last time. For me, that Ormus would be used at something like a gallon per acre. That's a seawater concentrate. So basically, you could use, you know, up to 50 gallons of seawater per acre, I guess. You know, basically, you want to be monitoring the conductivity. use as much as you need to get your conductivity up to where you want it. You can certainly fry thin if your conductivity goes too high. So this is not, there's too low, there's too high. You don't want to be in either place. You want to have a nice, moderate dynamic. And if you're curious about recipes and things like that, specifically the sea minerals, they will dramatically affect conductivity. So that'll tell you how much you should put in. And then finally, I said micronized calcium and phosphorus and traces. This can be easily manufactured with rock phosphate. Colloidal rock phosphate, Calphos, 15, 20 bucks, 50-pound bag. You take that and you put it again in a bucket of water, stir it up, come back 24 hours later, and the water will still be cloudy because it's colloidal. But the particle size is so small that it will stand in suspension in water. That is micronized calcium and phosphorus. And you need available calcium and phosphorus for roots to grow. Phosphorus is generally poorly available in the soil, especially in the spring. It's only made available through the activity of fungi, which a lot of people don't have well established in their soils. So a little bit of micronized rock phosphate in the hole is going to stimulate that root growth. And calcium is the other one. Rock phosphate is calcium phosphate, technically. So you need calcium and phosphorus for roots to grow. Oftentimes, you don't have them available to the roots for them to transplant into the ground. So if you mix all these things together and water them into the hole before you transplant, you should expect to see your plants get up and grow much more rapidly. A lot of people have the experience of putting seedlings into the ground and seeing them sit there for a while. Anybody have that experience? In many cases, they sit there until the food is coming and fall up or things like that. You want to see your plants grow, put them into an environment where they feel empowered, they feel like they've got everything they need, they flourish. That's what you want to see happening right away.
What is the amount of the wood or rock phosphate in that?
How much? As much as will stand in suspension. A few pounds per acre, 10 to 15 pounds per acre. It doesn't make much of the stuff to get in the effect. It really doesn't take much. Okay, and then you plan your transplant. So if you're seeding, spinach seeds and you made your row, I would water this water into the row first, then put my seeds in the row, then cover it. That makes sense. The way I do it is I have a sump pump in a spare, like a 55-gallon barrel of water, a 100-gallon barrel of water. I put a quart of, all the stuff mixed up together into the barrel, put a sump pump in there with a hose, and just come walk along the bed and just water all my holes first, then come through and transplant. Not very complicated. So I put my seedlings in, I put my drip tape down, and then I mulch. And then you're done. You really have very little to do until it comes time to harvest. If you do this right, gardening becomes much more fun. There's no weeding involved. You mulch that soil nice and heavy. It's fed, it's maintained moisture, and there's no sunlight for any weeds to ever germinate. It's just logistically, virtually impossible for them to establish.
What about the lettuce mix directly
into
the bed? How are you doing
that? If I'm broadcasting lettuce mix into the bed, I just broadcast it to a degree which I know is going to give you good coverage. And if I do this well, they will jump up and grow rapidly. I may have a few weeds here and there.
So you don't need to mulch that?
I certainly don't mulch anything I direct seed, like carrots, beets, radishes, lettuce, all that stuff that I'm going to be just broadcasting or even doing in rows.
So once it's grown, you don't come back and mulch it?
Nope. Those are leafy. Basically what's going to happen is they're going to create a canopy rapidly and then out to feed the leaves.
So do you come back and tuck a little hay in around them?
You certainly could. Feel free to. Certainly could. Yeah. Once the carrots are up and you've got a 3-inch space between your rows, you're going to come through there with a little bit of hay and most of the space between the rows, that's great.
Do you leave a little walk space that you walk on?
I always have about a foot wide trench. That is the path of my raised bed. And that's mulched, if not growing with a clover or something. Yeah, I try to keep the soil covered at all times as much as possible. I didn't want to see bare soil. If I got 3 days between when I prepare my soil and the lettuce germinates, so be it. That's not bad. I'm keeping it moist. That's the other thing, is I always keep the soil moist when I plant the seeds. If you plant the seeds, as soon as you do that, you're obliged to be there on a regular basis to keep the soil moist until it germinates. If you want to plant and come back 3 days later, July, it's a really bad idea. You want to be there at least. I mean, you have to watch the soil, and what you want to see is that it never goes from that dark wet color to the light dry color. You never want to see the soil dry out on the surface until the seeds germinate. It's extremely important. If you have to take a couple of days off from work, it's worth it, right? Put in a whole bunch of crops and keep them moist until they germinate. It's very important.
When you put the mulch after you plant your seedling, you said you were covering them always.
Up to the
I have heard that you want to be a little bit of air in the kind of not cover them. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean.
This is
I mean, if you're going to knock them over, I mean, I'm not, disease pressure is not a concern, it's part of the concern. Maybe it is a concern, feel free to give it some sticks. I want them to feel nice and cozy. I mean, it's just like, I don't know, making a bed or something, you know? It's just like,
no, it makes sense, but then, because I did that and then I was reading up on it, and I was saying you should actually spread them around the plant, just around the plant, not touch it.
Those nuances do it feel right to
you. You sort of talked around this, so I just want to make sure I understand. You're talking about putting things in the hole, but then you're also talking about broadcasting. I assume you're talking about different kinds of things.
These things are all liquid.
I'm sorry.
Everything I just described was a liquid.
Right. No, I'm just talking about, like, you talked about you're broadcasting some seed.
This recipe right here. Oh, seeds? You're talking about not production.
Seeds.
Yes, seeds.
So, depending on the type of plant,
yes.
You're broadcasting some, others you're growing and then transplanting it.
Exactly.
If you're broadcasting seeds and you do that, do you spray the bed with that mixture first? Or?
When I'm broadcasting seeds, okay, so good questions here. When I'm broadcasting seeds, so most people don't broadcast seeds for starters, right? Most people plant rows. Right? Well, some people broadcast seeds. What's that?
Well, it depends on what you're
you're growing.
Yeah.
For me, carrots, beets, rutabagas, turnips, parsnips, radishes, lettuce, Asian greens, they all get broadcasted. For me, I've got my 4-foot bed. I'll just throw the seed out there at a decent thickness. When they germinate, you know, I can thin them out if I need to, all the small ones. But I basically want to cover the entire bed. I don't see any use of them being rows all tight and then, you know, empty space. I'd like to see them more spread out. Yes, I will broadcast the seed, then I will lightly rake it in, and then I'll come through with a hose with a shower head nozzle and soak the entire bed.
Just with water?
Water. With water with this stuff in it. Yes, absolutely. And then continuously keep that whole entire bed moist until the germinates, which generally is, you know, 3 or 4 days, sort of not 1 or 2. I mean, Asian greens, arugula will germinate many times less than 2 days. 36 hours, it's up. That's ridiculous. Totally exciting. And it just takes off, and the weeds don't have a chance. Is that what you want to see?
Yes. So on top of
great
this,
part.
You have that seeds as well.
What's that?
So you're not putting your seeds before it as a separate from all of them.
Yes. There may be some overlap. From my perspective, you know, I'm being generous. And if you wanted to cut out certain steps, you could. Okay. So when I plant the transplant, I put the chip plate down, I put the mulch down, and we're good to go. Okay? Plants are in the ground. This is the most important part of the whole process. I would suggest that your warm weather crops, your plants that will freeze, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, cucumbers, squash, melons, all the warm weather crops would not like to go into the ground below 60 degrees. They prefer 65. And my cold weather crops, everything that can handle a frost, carrots, beets, radishes, onions, spinach, you know, all those lettuces, things like that, would not like to go into the ground below 50 and would prefer 55. Okay.
You're talking about air temperature or soil?
2 inches down. Soil temperature.
When the, that's why actually something that's confusing. When you look at the seed packets for radishes or, I mean, another thing for collards,
yeah.
They say put them in as soon as the soil can be worked. There's no way the soil is 2 degrees and the soil can be worked. So
right.
I've always been confused about that.
Put them in as soon as the soil can be worked and put them in 2 weeks later and see how they do. Don't believe me. Try it out.
No, but so you...
My experience is
better later than sooner.
These are babies that are being born. Anybody ever raised chickens?
Mm-hmm.
What happens with the old chickens if they get to be below 95 degrees? Dead. Right? If they're a week old, they can handle 80. But 65, they'll be dead. They're babies. How about a baby human? Ever, you know, taking care of a baby human? When they're freshly born, right, newborns, they're delicate. And the more you can create an environment where they have all the needs met, the more they're going to flourish. It's just common sense. If you think about human babies, think about animal babies, these are the same thing. They need the same things. It's so simple that we don't even remember to think it. Yes? It's just common sense. It's just straight common sense. And that's how it works. I'm not being too pushy. Just pushy enough. I feel like I've definitely been pushy.
You're passionate.
What's that? I've talked in New Yorkers.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you're very
You don't want to be a pushover.
I don't want to be a pushover. No. You're down at the bottom of the total hole. Picky at that. What it is.
Just one thing. Yeah. Just peas. Because some peas are actually supposed to plant like pretty darn early, like even right? I mean, peas are one of those. Like,
try it.
It's like don't put it in more. It's like frozen. You know.
Try it.
Okay.
They will germinate in cold temperatures, and they'll sit there for a while. They take 2 weeks to germinate. They, you know, the soil gets wet. It's cold. They rot. They finally germinate. They sit there for a week or two. Right? They're 3 weeks, 4 weeks after you put the seeds in the ground. They're 2 inches up.
Yeah.
You just sapped their life force. You want them to jump up out of the ground and grow.
That's true.
And you want to put them in an environment where they're going to do that. And that way they don't sap their life force.
Makes sense.
Potatoes? People always put their potatoes in early.
Very early.
Potatoes are the same family as tomatoes and eggplants.
Yeah.
Right? You can frost this potato till the leaves are dead. And it'll come back from the root because it's got a tuber, it's got vigor, it's got vitality. But that sure wasn't good for it. You want potato bugs? Put your, you know, potatoes into cold soil. Stress them out when they're young. They'll be weak. You know, they'll be susceptible. That's a great way to get a potato bug. Great. Put them in cold soil. Yeah. Okay. Good. I think we've covered this fairly thoroughly. This is a really important point. I'm glad we got it all out there. We can move rapidly to a lot of other stuff.
I have a question. A lot of stuff. I'm in raised beds.
Yes.
Not like your bed, but
in yes. Box.
Yeah. I can heat that soil up pretty easily. But what about like temperatures at night falling? I mean, I could get the soil temperature up.
Yeah.
But, I just wonder if it's still wise to start early, even though, you know.
I think in many cases that the day that the air temperatures are sufficient, much earlier than the soil temperatures are sufficient. And so, you know, if you want to cheat and warm the soil up a little bit early, a couple weeks early, you can still maintain your, you know, March or April planting dates, but you're just going to have much more vigor and vitality in your plants. Certainly, you know, 25 degrees is going to kill a lot of plants. And they really would not like to go below 35, they really would not like to go below 50. You know, and you can sort of the level of stress they can handle is a lot. But the more you can moderate and manage, if you've got little beds, I don't know if you can get out there every day, but put a little layer of plastic over them, pull it off in the morning, or roll it up, you know, for the first month of their life. But in a hot summer, I'm assuming it's sunny out, I have no idea, right?
Just talking about
60 degrees and sunny.
We should be outside.
No idea. could be rainy, could be snowing. On a sunny day in April, in a hoop house, it'll get to be 120 degrees. You'll fry eggs. Absolutely no problem getting over 100 degrees in this climate right now. What's going on right now will fry plants. Just totally fry. So, what's that?
How is frying plastic?
One layer of plastic on a sunny day in April. And the area, if the doors are closed, the heat in there will build up to over 100 easily. Try it out. You want a sauna? From April on, the sun's high enough in the sky. It really provides good solar gain. Okay, so we talked about plenty of transplants. Yes, sir.
Just one small little point. When you said about the broadcasting of the seed, you lightly break it in and you water it.
Yes.
Can you put the drip tape down?
Yes.
And that's just because it's all willy-nilly, so how do you put the drip tape? Just like you would in.
Just break down the bed.
All right.
And then germinate this side of it or that side of it. And I come through and cut them, and the drip tape's in the ground. So I use a drip tape to keep the soil moist throughout the life of the plant. Yes.
Now I'm confused about the gentleman was talking about the raised beds.
Yes.
He was asking about the night temperature. So when you're checking your temperature, you're probably checking it through the day, right? This is the one you're basing.
You have to get a max. What your soil temperature?
Okay.
2 inches down, your soil temperature is not going to go up much.
Okay.
Day or night.
Right.
It may go up or 2 degrees or down 3, but 2 inches down, it's a fairly. That's where it's at. It'll slowly. You good with this topic? We can move forward? Okay. Limiting factors here. This is just a sort of a pedantic statement. As with bioinoculants, in soil mineral balancing, plenty of dredge. Regular dredging and foliage is designed to address the relocation of the respiratory effects by the plant. So basically what I'm going to say is there is, from this point forward, having a regular program where you come through and water some goodies into the soil, foliar spray some goodies onto the leaf surface is good, proactive, preventative nutrition, functional. This is like giving your kids cod liver oil, right? You give them cod liver oil so they don't get sick. You do it on a regular basis. So for me, if it's a half gallon per acre of a foliar spray concentrate or a gallon per acre of a drench concentrate, then I mix up with water. Not much, but on a regular basis, it's good to go through and feed the plants a little. It's just sort of a general statement. We'll talk a little more about that in detail in the procedure in the handout. So that all being said, and understanding that if you do a good job with preventative management, you should preventative nutrition, you should minimize the symptomology of disease and discoloration. I want to spend now an extended number of slides on plant visual analysis. How do you look at a plant and see how it's doing? So what are some general character traits we're looking for? What kind of body language do you want to see in the plant? A. And then B, what are specific symptomologies of different mineral deficiencies, et cetera. So that's my next topic here. And I'd be happy to start in on it. But I think we will not get done before lunch. So what time do we have?
12:20.
12:20.
You want to take it now?
Early lunch?
Yeah. Yes.
All right.
1:20 on the dot.
1:20 on the dot.
I would just, before everybody starts to rush off, as a typical New Yorker, there's a couple of things I want to just announce. So could we, take a breath first and come back?
Sit back down. Okay. Nothing really.
You haven't gotten up yet.
So didn't tell you that he wanted to make some announcements. He wants to make some announcements.
So the first thing is, Dan and I hadn't worked out whether I'll take the money or he'll take the money for the products, but if somebody's taking the products, just let me keep a running list.
There's some goodies over there.
We're selling products on the other side of Dan's business. This is the for-profit business.
If you're going to bring this up, we have to let you talk for a second.
Yes. So you can talk.
All right. So what's going on here is something I never do in my courses, but I run through my organization. But because this is a special case, they'll talk to me into bringing this out. My experience as a farmer has been figuring all this stuff out, that A, it's good to understand, and then B, you need access to resources. And so I have not been able to find a good, source of a bunch of interesting things. So I've had to just, call people up and start getting them delivered. I basically run a business out of the business. I don't tell anybody about it. If they hear about it, that's great. But we've got some clues over there that work really well, if you want. So,
what are they for, the things over there?
The dry powder is the mixed inoculant of, you know, 30 different bacterial and 15 different fungal species. The liquid is everything I just gave you the recipe for, how to make it, that you water into the hole when you plant, and you can also use it as a regular drench and as a regular foliage spray. It's like a multivitamin, basically. Yes, you dilute that to a quarter cup per gallon of water. It's the most concentrated you would use it. It says the directions on there. And the heaviest application would be a cup per 1,000 square feet. A cup of concentrate per 1,000 square feet. So you're talking about, you know, a couple tablespoons in a backpack sprayer, don't spray your plants. You know, a couple tablespoons in your watering can, don't water your plants. And it's just regular, it's like your fish year by fish year plants.
Is it for the in-season foliar spray?
It's a foliar spray, it's a drench, it's called a complete liquid feed.
Okay.
It makes it all really simple, takes everything, puts it all in one tool, done.
Shelf life?
18 months at least. If the only thing that's going to happen is it'll precipitate, so you have to shake it up, and it'll be fine.
So a couple of people took, just check in with Dan and I.
There's obviously nowhere near enough there for everybody and everybody.
Right.
So.
And I just want to know what the finances are, separate from the running. So
I think they can just pay me. And that's
great.
That'd
be great.
Yeah.
So pay them.
And I've got a catalog at a website if you want.
So that's that. So anything else you can talk to Dan? So I wanted to announce to the room that, hi. So I'm aware that this weekend is a Joe's Food Conference. When we scheduled this, first of all, we had to postpone it, and I needed to get Dan in before the season really started, and Dan's schedule was packed. So this was the only day, and I was aware that it was a three-day weekend, and people are adults, and when I send out the original announcement, everybody has calendars, and they have technology up the wazoo. So who's ever made it, I'm really appreciative. And I really want to say whoever started email threading, I appreciate that. I haven't been well the last 2 months. Please don't come up to me and ask me how I am. I just want to put up some boundaries. I'm waiting for the results of a biopsy, and just putting that out to the room. But I do stuff like this, and this is what I really love doing. I'm on the board of TNG, and so for those who did start emailing, I appreciate that. It took something else off of my plate. So if we take a time check now, Dan's here for lunch. You can talk to him all hour. 12:23. Well, he told me that last time. He loves talking to him much. He can help me there. At 12:25 is the start again. And then I